the subdivision on justice programs, and I want to welcome everyone to this subdivision. And I want to announce a couple things. Number one is that each presenter is going to only be allowed 10 minutes in order to present. So if you have three testifiers or if you have two testifiers, then you can do the math. The only way that we go beyond that is if the committee has questions, and so we want to be respectful of that. Now, some people will ask the question, why am I doing it that particular way? It's a very simple answer. We have a number of bills to get through, and we want to make sure that the committee is alert and is able to ask the important questions. But I also think that when people are focused and they have only a certain amount of time, then they'll be much more substantive and much more direct. And so I wanted to make that announcement. And Jonae will keep time for me, so I'll make sure that I'm being fair. So as soon as you start talking, your time starts. The other thing that I would like to say, that we will make some small changes to the agenda. So there are some people who have alerted me that they have to leave early, and so I want to make sure that we try to accommodate that as much as humanly possible. So we ask for your patience as we get through this agenda. And the last thing that I think each presenter needs to know, or each author, is that the bills will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So we will not take any action specifically on any particular bill. So with that being said, I want to thank Senator Goodwin and Senator Hoffa for being here, as well as the other staff folks as well. So with that, we will have our first bill, and I who do we say first? No, we said a change. Carlson. Is Senator Carlson here? Senator Carlson. All right, I don't see him, but I did see Senator Tomassoni. Senator Tomassoni? So, Senator Tomassoni is Senate File 1340. Welcome, Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Senate File 1340, Mr. Chairman, is a result of a
And if you pull the mic closer to you so that we can hear you clearly.
Senate File 1340, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is a bill that's requesting $100,000 a year for the Advocates for Family Peace. And the reason for it is because what has happened on the Iron Ranges, the Range Women's Advocates has basically gone out of business, and the Advocates for Family Peace have taken over the obligations of that particular organization. And as a result of the timing and as a result of the funding, there's been a shortfall of the funding that has been given to this group in order to fulfill the obligations of the Range Women's Advocates. And maybe the best way to have this described to the committee is to have Melissa Skye, my testifier, who runs the Advocates for Family Peace, to give you the history and then all of the various attempts that she has made and that people have cooperated on in trying to get funding to them in order to fulfill the obligations. The organization of Range Women's Advocates, while they don't exist anymore, the needs for the services have not gone away. And so the Advocates for Family Peace have taken over those obligations, but the funding hasn't come with it. And as a result of the way the funding has been distributed, they're short on funding. And even though several different organizations, including the IRRRB and the United Way, on the Iron Range have stepped up and tried to help them with the funding, there's going to be a shortfall in the next year or so. And so this is an attempt to make sure that we can bridge that gap. So I'll turn this over to Melissa, and she can tell you what's going on.
Welcome to the committee. And if you identify yourself, your first and last name for the record, that'd be great.
Sure. Melissa Skye from Advocates for Family Peace. I'm the executive director there, and we serve Itasca County for many years, and since 1978. And then we partnered with Range Women's Advocates for many years. So Range Women's Advocates started as a collective, and then they changed to a director, and then they had some challenges, I'll just say, internally, and the state of Minnesota defunded them, defunded that entire service area. What I was told by the state, you know, is they got the lowest score of the state on the application process. And, of course, that was at the beginning of the five-year funding process, so the decisions were already made at that point, so it wasn't as if the state could then, you know, the money was gone, they've distributed, so it wasn't as if they could then say, oh, we have this extra, you know, for us. And so they had asked a number of organizations to take over a merge. We did not merge because they were being sued by a former employee, so that's why we just, they had to totally disband as a nonprofit, so they no longer exist as a nonprofit. And then we expanded our service area to northern St. Louis County, which is a huge geographical area, you know, all the way to the Canadian border. And just to say, as an example, many places which we haven't even been able to go. So we have three full-time staff there, but only two of those staff can work with adult victims. One of them is obligated to just children. So we have a massive geographic area space for and two advocate staff. The state of Minnesota then did give us, during the unmet needs funding process, they did give us some money, $59,000. They did give us, which is not, you know, it's about half of what Range Women's Advocates was getting before. And I also want to say that, you know, we support the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women also and their ask as well, but you should know that we will not benefit like other programs will because we don't have the base money, you know, on top of that. So you should know that we'll benefit, but not, you know, close to the same degree that other people will because we don't get the base money that other programs get in the state. So we've never, ever asked the legislature for money ever before. I want you to know that. And we just feel like it's a unique situation because we took over for a service area that it wasn't receiving anything. If we wouldn't have stepped in, the United Way of Northeast Minnesota gave an extraordinary amount of money to us. They gave $75,000, which is unheard of in their area. They took some money out of their savings, actually, to help for the first 2 years and then said, you know, after that, we can't help you at that amount. And so they're unable to help us, and we've exhausted all local resources to get through until we can apply for the five-year competitive process again. We did get a VAWA Special Projects grant for 2 years and reapplied for that and was not awarded that again, which is typical because it's a competitive process. And so we're asking for this because it's a unique situation. It's not to add something to our service. It's just to do what everyone else does in the state. And we have this big hole and gap in northern St. Louis County because that agency has disbanded and lost their funds.
And so, Ms. Skye, can you tell me what your overall budget is?
Yep. So the overall budget for Advocates for Family Peace is, you know, $800,000, but that includes Itasca County. And so I want to just say, you know, if you saw the records, that's what you would see. But for just, you know, the operating budget over in northern St. Louis County to finish this fiscal year, we're asking for next fiscal year, you know, is about $120,000. And that's what the United Way, you know, filling in and filling up some of those gaps for the basic funding. And then right now, the other thing you should know is that we are exploring another merger with the Domestic Violence Program in Duluth as another way to reduce costs and be more efficient with our funds. So we have some special project money as it relates to that, then I'm not counting in that money, that $120,000, because we're going through an explore merger to combine also with southern St. Louis County. But, you know, as you know, that money would have to stay to serve that area. But, of course, it'll help financially when, you know, we basically it looks like we'll probably have shared administration, keep our same identities is what's most likely to happen. So we'll still be Advocates for Family Peace. But so we're really sort of considering all those options going forward.
Now, you indicated
Mr. Chairman, that thump, thump, thump you were
Senator
hearing,
Tomasoni.
That was a heartbeat, and that means have a heart and fund this, because that's what that was all about.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. And to the testifier again, Ms. Skye, you indicated that this program was defunded by the state.
Well, it didn't receive the basic money, right? I mean, defunded to the extent that Range Women's Advocates applied, like everybody has every 5 years, and they got a letter saying you get zero money.
Right. Any questions from the testifier?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
To our testifier, it said you got the lowest score. What does that mean?
Yeah, we didn't. The previous organization did, Range Women's Advocates. When we asked the state of Minnesota why Range Women's Advocates got zero money. Their response to us was that, you know, the grants are peer-reviewed and internally reviewed, and they get a score. And so, you know, the decisions are made based on that. And so they said that application got the lowest score in the entire state. It's actually unheard of. I don't know of any, you know, somebody that's kind of operating well. I mean, there were problems there for sure. I mean, that's, you know, in part. You know, it was a different organization as time went on. But that's what the state told us, and because they had some internal financial controls problems, is, I guess, a general way to say it. That's why they got defunded.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
You had talked about the defunding, and you also, I think, talked about having some financial problems. Remind me again what your financial problems, why you didn't meet budget.
Well, that wasn't us, so I just want to, yeah.
Okay.
So that was Range Women's Advocates, a totally separate organization that I never worked for or in. So that's what we're, I'm going to distance myself there a bit. But yeah, so that was, they had financial problems there. And so when they were sort of falling apart, one of their advocates actually just called me and said, do you think your organization would ever consider helping us out, merging, or taking us over? Because we're having financial problems. And so that's when we started to meet with them, and the United Way helped, the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women helped us figure out what that would look like when we took over that service area.
But when you
Senator
took
Hall.
Them, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you took them over, you understood that you would put yourself financially in a hole?
Well, we didn't put ourselves financially in the hole. We didn't put ourselves financially in the hole in Itasca County because that money is allocated for Itasca County. Mm. We knew we were taking over a big, big challenge. That's what we knew.
Okay.
And I live in that service area, and, you know, I wouldn't have a heart if I said, oh, well, I'll help the county next door, but no, you all people, you know, fend for yourselves. It wasn't going to happen. I mean, all of us just knew that we were the most likely organization to just expand our border to northern St. Louis County, and so that's what we did. But we knew coming in, because the state, you know, we asked the state, is there anything? I will say that there was one year we got a little bit of the give-back money. Somebody didn't spend, I think we got like maybe $15,000, you know, at the end of that first fiscal year, but we knew there wasn't any money to apply for the basic money. So we did apply for one of the competitive grants and got those. But yes, we knew most certainly. So we've been trying to, you know, scrape up every resource possible locally. And, you know, the United Way has just really said, we're going to do everything we can for 5 years for you. And so, but they, you know, dipped into their savings quite a bit those first 2 years.
Sure.
So.
Well, thanks for what you do.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Skye, can you tell us the number of clients that you have served or you are projected to serve if you were to receive this increased period, or just what your current budget would allow?
Yeah, so a way to think about it is a couple ways, one of which is, you know, it's anywhere from 200 to 300 new people a year, which is about the same as what it was for Itasca County. The way I like to talk about it, though, is that in a couple ways in northern St. Louis County, one of which is because we only have two staff that can work with adult victims, we don't meet the needs that come in every day. So the police reports get faxed to us every day, and we are not able to answer all those requests. So every domestic violence victim where their partner was arrested or was a victim, they don't get a call every day because we don't have enough people to do it. I mean, sometimes it's 12 of them come in and we have two people. And the thing about it, if there are 12 people who all they need is information referral and a five-minute phone call, yes, we can help them. But if you get one person who comes with nothing, then that can take two people for the whole day. So the number of people means less to me than what the people who come to us need, and it's always a variation in variety.
Any other questions from the committee?
And Mr. Chairman, just to wrap it up for you.
Senator Tomasoni.
Ms. Skye understands it way better than I do, but my understanding of it, and I was rather outraged when I found out that Range Women Advocates was denied funding by the state because it wasn't as if all of a sudden the need for the organization went away. Now, admittedly, there were some internal accounting problems that were going on at the organization, and they did need some new management. And Ms. Skye did decide to take over the organization and add the services that they do to her workload. But ultimately, what ended up happening is that because they didn't get any funding from the state, now they need more funding. And because this five-year grant cycle is only applicable once, they can't get the funding through the five-year grant cycle until the end of the five-year period is up. And so this is just some bridge funding that'll get them through that period. And I'm pretty confident, based on who's running the organization, that they'll be just fine once we get through this five-year grant cycle and they get this bridge funding in. But it's a matter of being able to fund what we've got right now and then get to the next step.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Any questions for Senator Tomasoni? Seeing none, we'll lay Senate File 1340 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Senator Carlson, I think he is now in the room, and we're going to look at Senate File 851. Welcome, Senator Carlson, and I'm sure that someone has relayed the information to you that there will only be allowed 10 minutes worth of presentations for the bill, and then the committee can go beyond that, needless to say, if they have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
All right. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and members, I have Senate File, and I believe we are looking at Senate File 851 first here. Thank you for moving it into higher in the agenda. Senate File 851 provides an appropriation for de-escalation training, and this is intended for the law enforcement community to be able to deal with veterans who perhaps have different issues where they may be belligerent or may be needing just a little bit of their own type of language to be able to deal with stresses in their lives, and also when the law enforcement is called to deal with them. With me, I have Mr. John Baker, an attorney from Baker Williams, and also Mr. Bill Miklos, the Associate Director of Upper Midwest Policing Institute. And I'll ask them to be able to stay within the time limits and be able to tell the committee what the de-escalation strategy is.
And Senator Carlson, do you want Mr. Baker to go first?
I would like to have Mr. Baker go first.
All right.
Yes.
Mr. Baker, if you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, it'd be great.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Attorney John Baker. I am with the Baker Williams Law Firm. I'm also retired from the United States Marine Corps. I spent 22 years in the Marine Corps. I chaired the initiative a few years ago to start veteran courts in Minnesota, and as the chair knows, we have veteran courts. It started in Hennepin County, and there are throughout the state of Minnesota. Through that work, I got involved with the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute, teaching this course. This course is, and this funding, Mr. Chair, is an extenuation of funding that originated in 2014. It went to the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute. We developed this course, and actually this is an extension from funding we got from the Department of Justice a year or so before that to create a national program. But we created this program, and we've been teaching it around the state of Minnesota. One of the things in your packet, Mr. Chair, is a map of the trainings that we've done around the state and what we're proposing to do and what's scheduled. Mr. Miklos will talk a little bit more about the numbers. But I want to say, Mr. Chair, you know, we've had 2.5 million Americans that have served in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The studies say that there's a quarter of those troops are coming home with actual diagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. Some of those troops, many of them do not report their condition or seek help. Some of them, a small percentage of them, are ending up in our criminal justice system. You know, Mr. Chair, as I'm on my way to the Capitol today, and you may have seen it, on the front steps of the Capitol today are combat boots. And it's done by Operation 23-0. It's a new nonprofit that started. The idea behind it is there's 23 veterans that commit suicide around the nation every day. and what they want to do on these boots. And I had the honor of donating a pair of combat boots that I went around the world with to symbolize a veteran committing suicide. You know, what this bill does, Mr. Chair, is it helps reduce suicide by cop, because unfortunately, and we don't have any numbers on that because that's not something that's captured, but this goes a long ways to reducing suicide by cop. So I'm involved with the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute, and as the chair knows, and what we do is we go around the state of Minnesota teaching law enforcement how to deal with veterans in crisis. And as the chair knows, I'm a criminal defense attorney.
Absolutely.
And I also go with a retired police officer. So, you know, when we first introduce ourselves and I say I'm a criminal defense attorney, they don't like us. They don't like me too well. But at the end of the day,
I like you. I want you to know that I like you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the end of the day, they know that you know, this is a strong message that we're delivering. We're all on the same team. It's all helping our next greatest generation of veterans coming home from these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan be successful. And that's what we're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Mr. Miklas.
Yes, thank you. My name is William Miklas, and I am the Associate Director of the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute. I'm also a retired police sergeant at the city of Burnsville, Minnesota. For most of my career, responding to calls, especially calls in progress with people that may be termed disorderly or emotionally disturbed, the training was focused on tactics. Along the way, we wanted to make sure the police officers certainly are handling these calls in a safe manner, but we're also recognizing that there's more to responding to a person with dealing with a personal crisis than just tactics and being safe. We developed this curriculum, as John Baker mentioned, in association with a police officer as well as a military person to help bridge the gap between dealing with somebody that's having a reintegration crisis, coming home from a wartime situation and having a hard time adjusting back into civilian life. This training has been effective. We have, with the last funding cycle, we were able to train 825 Minnesota peace officers up to this point, and by mid-May, that number will be pushing 1,000. Now, our goal is to reach a tipping point of 2,500. As you may know, there's just short of 10,000 licensed peace officers in the state of Minnesota. Our goal of 2,500 trained in this methodology here will certainly create a tipping point and the ability to influence each other police officers who maybe haven't had this training but are able to be influenced by others that have, in order to make sure that this becomes a newer method of police practices in addition to the other tactical training that they do receive.
So thank you so very much. A couple questions to either testifier. You've talked about the curriculum that's used in order to train peace officers. Can you tell me a little bit about who helped to develop that tool and whether you used any mental health professionals that could help, relay what information should be, what tools should be utilized to de-escalate a situation?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may. So we initially developed this curriculum with the Department of Justice and the COPS office, the Community-Oriented Policing Office. And we went through their curriculum development, and they had all the mental health professionals. We have, and I was involved with developing this curriculum here. What we're able to do with the Minnesota curriculum is we made it even better. And by the way, we're the only state that's doing this around the country, Mr. Chair. We've got this national thing that we're doing, but we're the only state that's concentrating on this. But we have a whole section that we deal with the psychological issues, the PTSD and the TBI, and we've worked with mental health professionals with that, and we continue to do that, and we continue to update ourselves on the latest stuff that's going on with these issues.
Mr. Baker, is there an evaluative tool that you all use in order to determine whether the information that you provide to law enforcement officers is useful in the field?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's
Baker.
That is one of the difficult things. So what are the numbers? How are we successful? And I don't know of a tool other than we get officers everywhere we go, we say we need feedback. We need, if you have an instance that you are experiencing a veteran in crisis, let us know. But the FBI and their crime statistics do not capture this kind of information. President Obama signed the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention Act a few weeks ago, and that's $22 million to go to the VA to work on suicides issues. And what I'm trying to get the VA to capture this information of how many veterans are getting involved with the criminal justice system. We simply don't know. You know, Mr. Chair, when I started veteran courts, I was asked the same thing. And essentially I said, you know, build it and they will come. And, you know, and as the chair knows, what came first were Vietnam veterans. And our veteran courts were filled with Vietnam veterans. But we have our current conflict veterans that are in these veteran courts now, too. But we don't – there's really not an evaluative tool that we have other than give us feedback, let us know.
Any questions from the committee?
Yep.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, Mr. Bickless, what year did you finish up with Burnsville?
The year 2000.
Mr. Bickless.
Okay. That was just before
Senator
I
Hall.
Worked with them. So you had Dumoulin.
There, yes.
Yep. Okay. So my understanding is, first off, I guess I wanted to ask, the military is providing some of this information, and police officers right now, I assume, have some idea of de-escalation and how to work with it. And so you're coming up with something new? Is that what you're doing? Or
Mr.
is
Chair.
It? Yeah.
Mr. Bickless?
It's a new collection of information. Typically, this information is reserved for experienced police officers, negotiators, crisis intervention team members, people that are on call, perhaps, rather than first in the field out there working as first responders today. What our emphasis is pushing this down to the line officers, the first responding officers, not only in police, the deputy sheriffs, corrections, jailers, dispatchers, anybody that has a point of contact with a veteran in crisis will have more awareness now of what to do and how to deal with the de-escalation that are particular for veterans. We know that veterans are a subset of other emotionally disturbed people. And everybody goes through their time in the bucket, so to speak, at some point in time. Veterans have an unusual life experience, and they bring that to the party, so to speak. And we found not necessarily with measurable information, but anecdotal information, feedback from our students in class is saying, hey, what we were talking about yesterday just did it, and it worked. I had a call last night, and it worked. So we are getting that kind of feedback anecdotally again, but not measurably.
Okay.
Senator Hall, any other questions?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Anything else? Any other questions? All right. With that, Senator Carlson, any last words you want to say about this particular bill before we lay it over?
I appreciate you hearing it, and I believe you're going to put this lay this over for possible inclusion. And I appreciate your support.
I did have one last question. Someone said that in 2014 that there was an appropriation, a one-time appropriation. Can someone tell me how much that was?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes. Mr. Baker.
Let me get that out here, Mr. Chair. So in 2014, it was Representative Detmer and Senator Rest that had a bill for $100,000 appropriation over 2 years. Actually, it was $200,000 over 2 years. We got $50,000. The next year in the same biennium, the last biennium, Representative O'Driscoll and Senator Rest asked for $50,000 additional funding. That did not pass. So this is coming back again this year. So this class is, we continue to teach it with the initial $50,000 funding that came out of 2014, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you so very much. No other questions to that? Okay. With that, we will lay Senate File 851 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so very much. Mr. Carlson, Senator Carlson, you have another bill, which is Senate File 691.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do.
All right.
Senate File 691 is to provide funding for the East African Women's Shelter. Minnesota has welcomed new Americans from nations with very different cultures, languages, and community standards. One of these, of course, is Somalia. There are some cultures that are vastly different than what we experience here, and this shelter is one that deals with specifically with Somali women and is a domestic violence shelter, a shelter for teaching them American ways, and also to some degree to help with assimilation and to protect the young people that are part of this culture. With me, I have Ms. Vario Khalif, the Executive Director of the Voices of East African Women, and she will give you some more information.
Welcome, Ms. Vario Khalif. If you will identify yourself for the record and then go forward with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee of Members. I am Vario Khalif. I'm with Voice of East African Women. We are working on it to open this first East African women's shelter in the state of Minnesota. The need is very urgent for women to come gather where they can get assistance. I'm aware of it. There's a wonderful, grateful, many shelters around the state of Minnesota, including the ones the biggest support we get from is a Harriet Tubman, where even though they are so big, sometimes they do themselves need some help. When over the night, sometimes they fill out when the woman needs to go to and overnight sleeping. This East African shelter is the first in the state. It will help women come together where they can culturally appropriate and religionally appropriate. They will help support and programs that will fit their need as an East African woman, as a Muslim community.
Okay. And it's my understanding, Ms. Khalif, that you all received one-time funding the last biennium. Is that right? And I believe it was $150,000. And can you tell me how that one-time funding helped your organization, if it did?
This is correct. Why we are asking the support for the state of Minnesota is because we are a new organization, and we are gathering. This is because our culture is needed, as where the women can come together. Instead of every day they go to the mosque, where always the mosque is great, it's a great religion and support places to go to, but also we'll need a place for them to come together and share their ideas as a woman, where you don't get from that as the mosque, but as a woman, where they can feel the need and the support with the shelter. But the funding we get is not enough. We need where we can have appropriate, for where women can come together. And this shelter needs more support than it did get before.
Any other questions? Senator Hall.
To our testifier, where is the shelter at?
It's in Ramsey County.
In Ramsey. Okay.
Yes.
Any other questions? Mr. Carlson, anything in closing? Senator Carlson?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think all of us, most of us, are willing immigrants. And in my past, it took a couple of generations for my Swedish father and for my German mother to get to the point where they got to when I was young. And I think they could have used something that was culturally specific, language specific, in their particular immigration adjustment and assimilation. And I think this is appropriate for us to consider. And also, I welcome the Somali community to Minneapolis and St. Paul, one of the largest communities in the nation. And I think we should approve this. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Senator Hall.
To the testifier again, where's the largest East African gathering of people in Minnesota?
Ms. Khalif.
Where they live.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Hall. I believe we are expanding around the state of Minnesota, but right now we and more, we'll say Minneapolis, and now it's becoming Rochester, St. Cloud, Ramsey County, Anoka County. So we are... Yeah,
right.
The state of Minnesota is the largest of the United States.
And my then thought, thank you, Mr. Chair, is why are you in St. Paul if the major group is in Minneapolis?
We are, our main office is in Minneapolis. The heart of the office is Minneapolis. So because we want to protect a woman, instead of she goes to the usual places that she goes to, we want to protect her a little bit away, but it's still, we are the heart of what it's another Somali community, but this is will give the women a little space away from them.
Sure.
And so I think what the testifier is also saying is that Minneapolis may be where a largest concentration is, but not exclusive to
absolutely
Minneapolis. So thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair.
And we'll lay Senate File 691 over for possible inclusion.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
Is Senator Franzen here? Senator Franzen? Welcome, Senator Franzen. I'm not sure, and I've been saying it to everyone, that they got my note and memo about 10 minutes of presentation, and then, okay, thank you. Perfect. I just wanted to be fair. But it's so good to see you, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I hope everybody had a great break, but we're here back to business. So in front of you, we have Senate File 184, and this bill deals with the youth intervention programs. I carried the bill last biennium where we funded the program at $5 million for the fiscal year 2014 and 2015. And we had a supplemental budget bill last year, and an additional $500,000 was appropriated. And the reason that I think this bill did get funded and has support is, and we're requesting in this year's biennium to fund the program at $5 million each fiscal year. The reason we supported it before and we asked for you to respectfully consider supporting it again is because the investment pays off. Youth who participate in intervention programs do better in schools. They have better skills. 90% don't commit new offenses while in the program. And the second investment, it's a great investment for a state budget. When you consider the cost of alternatives such as incarceration, recidivism, it's a great return on our investment. There was a study done back a few years ago by Wilder Research and by the University of Minnesota, which found that every dollar invested with youth intervention programs received a $4.89 return on investment. And at a cost of $2,000 a year per youth, certainly it's a cheaper alternative than alternatives like residential treatment, which can cost the state $75,000 just about a year, group homes $56,000, and juvenile correction facility $40,000 a year. NYIPA has a great track record. I've actually been to some of the program offerings throughout our metro area, and I actually went to a graduation of a NYIPA program a few years ago. And certainly it's a great program for kids to be doing what they should be and getting better grades at school and getting more engaged in their learning, and rather than doing naughty things out in the community. So we want to make sure that we support these efforts to support our kids and invest in our future. And with that, I want to turn it over to a couple of testifiers, three testifiers real briefly today. We'll start with Paul Munier, who's the Executive Director of the Youth Intervention Program Association, and then we have a couple more testifiers for the committee to briefly entertain. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good.
Hi, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Identify yourself for the record.
And yes, my name is Paul Munier. I'm the Executive Director of the Youth Intervention Programs Association, more commonly known as YIPA. Thank you for the opportunity today to talk with you about the importance of youth intervention. Before I give my testimony as it relates to Senate File 184, I'd like to introduce two people who are here to talk about youth intervention today. And I know we have to be super brief, so we've all been instructed to be really fast. So I would like to first introduce Mr. James Backstrom.
Thank you so much. Mr. Backstrom, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. I've had the privilege of serving as county attorney in my community since 1987. I've long been an advocate for a balanced approach to juvenile justice and keeping our young people safe in schools and in our neighborhoods. And I'm a strong believer in crime prevention efforts, focused on doing what we can to keep youth out of trouble by providing after-school activities, making connections with youth-serving organizations such as those that are part of the YIPA organization. I believe that investing in our youth will ensure successful and productive adults. These types of youth intervention programs provide positive role models, reduce truancy, keep our kids out of the criminal justice system. These programs also encourage consistent and appropriate discipline and provide opportunities to learn. Effective youth intervention programs can produce an increased sense of belonging, more positive influences, and greater development of social skills for our youth, all of which give young people greater chances of success in life. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and my association, along with the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, the Minnesota Sheriffs Association, and the Minnesota Juvenile Officers Association, have all passed resolutions of support for youth intervention programs such as those that would be funded through this bill. These efforts improve lives, save money, and keep our communities safer, and keep our at-risk youth from falling through the cracks. So I encourage you to strongly support this this bill. Thank you for having me here today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Backstrom, and thank you for your service as the Dakota County Attorney. Any questions for Mr. Backstrom before he has to leave? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to then introduce Trenton Washington, a 14-year-old young man.
Yep.
By the way, the best-dressed person in the room today.
I'll say.
I am inclined to agree because I like the bow tie and the vest, I might add. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record, Mr. Washington, and then you can continue.
My name is Trenton Washington.
Okay.
All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Trenton Washington. I am 14 years old, and I attend at Linwood Monroe. When I began the youth intervention program with Boulder Options, I was failing in school, stealing phones, and I was also charged with third-degree burglary, and I was also stealing large quantities of food from the store. And for those reasons, I was expelled from my school. After that, I had to go to a different school, and I realized that I needed to straighten up and fly right. The intervention program really helped me to channel my energy in a more positive way. The goal setting and the activities really helped me because I was surrounded by a more positive influence. One of my favorite activities was going to the Vikings training camp. Another reason why I started to do well was my mentor. He was always a positive role model for me, and he always encouraged me to do better, and he never saw me as a bad person when I was stealing things. Personally, I think I have the best mentor in the business. Now I'm succeeding in school, I'm in all accelerated classes, and I have over a 3.5 GPA in school. I am not getting into any more trouble. Instead of being known as a thief and a failing student, I'm known as a young, polite gentleman that is an excellent student. I'm very thankful for the Youth Intervention Program and being a part of Boulder Options. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say congratulations to this young man because he has obviously worked very hard to straighten out his life, and sounds like you did a good job. And I also want to say thank you to Paul Manier because I have known him for many years in this work that he's been doing, and he's doing a wonderful job. And it's not always an easy one, but you've done a wonderful job helping kids. Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier? Well, I will say that it looks like you're trying to take my job, young man. but with pleasure, and I'm glad that you are doing well. Any other questions for Mr. Washington before we turn back to the testifiers?
Well, Mr. Chair, may I ask the timekeper how much time I've left?
3 minutes.
Three minutes. Okay.
As I mentioned, I'm the executive director of YIPA. We are a statewide association of 193 organizational members that provide youth intervention services throughout the state of Minnesota. YIPA is small. We only have three staff, but we represent tens of thousands of youth intervention workers, volunteers, and about 300,000 at-risk youth throughout the state of Minnesota. We see youth as untapped assets and contributors to the common good. Letting these youth fall through the cracks and develop serious and chronic problems is unsustainable, and it simply causes our young people to be lifelong consumers of our public services. We need to reform the way we look at troubled youth. They are simply not going to go away, and we pay for them one way or another if we don't intervene. Youth intervention is a shift from an expensive and failed strategy to an approach that is significantly less expensive and produces much better results. As Senator Franson mentioned, youth intervention works. It saves money, and we clearly need more of it. We are not getting to all the kids that could benefit from youth intervention services. Senate File 184 will improve outcomes and in a number of ways. First, it'll increase the biennium appropriation, which will reach about another 15,000 kids. So 5 million for 2 years will reach 15,000 kids. Just compare that to some of the other numbers you hear at the state capitol. It's a good value. The 2-to-1 match, we're asking to reduce that to a 1-to-1 match, and that will put the money in the organizations that need it the most. Small startup, racially specific groups, a lot of times in the inner city and rural Minnesota, where they don't have the resources to serve the kids that they need. And finally, it'll give 5% to the Youth Intervention Programs Association, or YIPA, and we will leverage that money. We will monetize it and hire staff that we will be able to then become self-sustaining, because we will make that position self-sustaining. We plan to reduce our allocation of the YIP bill and completely phase it out. We would rather see our members get it, but we need to reform things. So, Mr. Chair and members of this committee, our current approach to our at-risk youth is costly and it does not work well. I understand you have to live within your targets provided to this committee. However, I'm asking you to come together in a bipartisan manner and prioritize how you spend. If the roof of your house is leaking, you can choose to let it leak, but it will cost you so much more when you have rotten sheetrock, moldy insulation, and a crumbling foundation. The fiscally prudent approach is to fix the roof before it becomes a larger problem and a much more expensive problem to deal with. The same is true about our at-risk youth.
Well, thank you for that information and that time. Thank you. Now, to Senator Frenzen. Senator Frenzen, it is my understanding that you all had a base in the last, well, the base is like $2.5 million a year. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, I would defer to fiscal. I know that it was funded last biennium at $5 million, so that was for the biennium, so that sounds right.
Yeah, okay. And then that's from the testifier, he said that would serve about another 15,000 students if we increase it by another $5 million. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct.
And my last question, unless someone else here wants to say something, there's a requirement for a match. And I can understand the reason for the match, but in your experience, does the match undermine the ability for less resourced agencies to participate, or have you experienced any challenges around that?
Mr. Chair, it
yes.
certainly does. We heard time and time again with the last increase in the appropriation, we had small organizations that couldn't do a 2-to-1 match. Some of the large organizations could have a 30-to-1 match. It wouldn't matter to them. The only thing the 2-to-1 match is doing is hurting is the small and rural areas that are the most resource poor. So we want to deliver those resources to where they're most needed.
Any other questions to the testifier?
Address the match. It also increases the grant ceiling.
Can you tell me a little bit just before I go to Senator Hall if he has a question? It is my understanding that you are looking to also increase the ceiling, and it's going from 50,000 to 75,000. Can you talk a little about that and why you believe that that is an important change?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. We have 193 organizations that do youth intervention services throughout the state of Minnesota. We do not have one organization that does not have a waiting list waiting for kids to get services. We need to get some more money to some of these organizations so that they can have the staff to reach these kids. They haven't had an increase in a long time. Matter of fact, it went down when we went through the recession. Most of the allocations went down over the history of those years.
Any other questions for the testifier? Any last words, Senator Frenzen, and thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just wanted to reiterate the importance of these programs and the really thank you for listening to the bill, and it's a bipartisan bill that has been before, and I really appreciate the co-authors and certainly want to really express your consideration to support this bill again, once again, in this biennium. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Senator Frenzen. And with that, we will lay Senate File 184 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you so much. Senator Goodwin.
Yes.
And then I know that Senator Eaton has to leave soon, so I'll try to accommodate as quickly as possible. But we're going now to Senator Goodwin, Senate File 210. Senator Goodwin, thank you so much for being here, and you may go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 210 appropriates $250,000 each year for services to survivors of family suicide, accidental deaths, and homicides. In your packet, you'll find several letters that show how well Survivors Network has done to help families who experience these tragedies. The letters are quite compelling, and I read every one of them, and they're from districts all over the metropolitan area, and this group has goes out and really seeks out and finds people that have suffered these recent tragedies and helps them through spending time with them, through support groups, weekly support groups, and helps them get their lives back together again as much as they can after one of these tragedies. I actually had the opportunity to become close friends with one of these families. About 2.5 years ago, a man who was laid off from his job went back and murdered 6 people and himself. His parents and sister were devastated by the murders that resulted from actions by their very own, very ill son. Survivor Resources contacted the family within a couple of days and started working with this wonderful couple. The pain of their loss and the losses experienced by the other families never really leaves them, but at least they've been able to get on with their lives and free of this, of course not, but at least be able to survive this devastation themselves. And here with me is County Attorney John Choi, who has had experience with these programs, and I do believe he initiated this program to begin with. No? Okay. Well, I guess that's a misstatement. Sorry. But I was going to give you some credit there. Okay. So he'll explain a little bit about the wonderful work that's being done. This group is located in the St. Paul Police Department, but they certainly my friend is from Richfield, and they go all over the place to help people that are in these situations.
All right. Welcome, Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, and if you'll state your name clearly for the record again and go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney, and it's a real pleasure to be here. First of all, I want to thank Senator Goodwin for her leadership in bringing this bill forward.
If you pull the mic a little closer to you,
and
please.
This bill, Senate File number 210, I think is so critically important, and oftentimes we forget about surviving victims. Oftentimes as it relates to suicide, homicide. The reality is that what has happened is just a huge, huge loss for these surviving family members. And one of the hardest things for me to do as the county attorney is actually have to meet with surviving members. And, you know, whenever I have that moment or that opportunity, you know, I'm always very nervous. And, I don't know what to say, because oftentimes what I'm going to say isn't going to bring back their loved one. But once we have a court case and it's resolved, and there's a sentencing, the reality is that the loss is still there. And this organization and organizations like it provide that infrastructure for that healing and for these surviving families. And I just think it's so critical that we support this as a state. As the Ramsey County Attorney, I can tell you that many of the victims, the surviving family members, they're from all over the state. They're all from the region. And this organization, if you were to help them, because at one point they did have state funding, but I think they could do so much more for our state and really help a group of people that really need it. And so with that, there's other testifiers here, and I'll cede my time to them.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say Kathy Vasterling is our next testifier, and actually we have a mutual very close friend that lost her life in the last few months on a trip to Ireland and got in a terrible car accident. And she had some tragedies in her life before that happened. So Kathy will talk about that.
All right, to the testifier, Ms. Vasterling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Kathy Vasterling, and I've been a part and around Survivors Resources since 1998 when my stepson, Josh Christensen, was murdered. Survivor Resources showed up at our house, Susie's and my house, and if it weren't for Margaret and her organization, I don't know what we would have done to get through those first few months of the deep grief that we were feeling. So my relationship with Survivor Resources started in 1998, and then 2005, my cousin Vinny died accidentally in Ramsey County Jail. In 2014, February, my nephew Ben died of an accidental drug overdose. And then in September of 2014, we lost our Susie Maher. She and I were partners for over 22 years, raised kids together. And in that tragedy, and every time I turned around, there stood Margaret McAbee and Survivor Resources shoring us up, making sure we could get through the route of the murder of Josh, making sure we could get the answers and information for my cousin Vinny, because he did die inside the jail. And then my nephew Ben, his accidental overdose, once again Margaret and her troops came in and shored up my brother and shored up my family. And each and every time that we've had to sadly call on Margaret and her group, it's been because of a tragic death or accidental or murder. So in that, I would love for you folks to support the Survivor Resources Bill and Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Senator Mr. Goodwin. Chair. Also, I want to say that Susie Maher, the one that died of the car accident in Ireland in September, was also a longtime staff person at the Minnesota House.
30-plus years she worked for you folks.
So is this Ms. Snyder?
Yes. Good afternoon.
And if you identify yourself for the record and go forward with your testimony, please.
Yes, sir. My name is Irene Schneider, and thank you for having me here, Mr. Chair and committee members. My daughter, Megan Fisher, was murdered in 2003. It was a domestic abuse situation, and we didn't even know she was murdered. We just couldn't find her. And we threw Meg's friends, we found out that late that evening, and we had, we ended up at Minneapolis Police Department and discussing and trying to figure out who did this and why. Anyway, so that was it was such a shock, and immediately I get a phone call from a group, Survivor Resources. I don't know who they are, and I'm thinking, I don't need any more press. I don't need any, because, you know, when something like this happens, a lot of people are out there asking, you know, how do you feel? What are you going to do? Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so at Megan's wake, Dina, who was the person from Survivor Resources I dealt with, showed up at Megan's wake, introduced herself, and from that day on, I listened to her, I talked to her, I went to support the grief support groups that they had. I then ended up volunteering for Survivor Resources, and then I was asked to be on the board. I served for 6 years, and the first year that Megan died, I started a fundraiser because I knew Survivor Resources needed the money. And since that year, 2003, this another one's coming up this year. It'll be number 13 because we had two in 1 year. Megan's friends did the first one. So they reach out to everybody. They give free their love, their care, their support. They hold you in their arms, and they just give and give, and they need funding. They need the money. There are so many people they need to reach, and so many people that are going to need their support, and they need the funding, and they need to hire qualified people to help. I mean, Margaret has just been absolutely wonderful. I love her to death, and there's been a lot of my friends who have gone through a lot of trauma too, okay, with accidental death, and they have called me because they've met Margaret through me. So I'm still trying to give to this organization that gave so much to me and my family.
Well,
thank you.
Ms. Snyder, thank you so much for your testimony and our condolences for your loss.
Thank you.
Senator Goodwin, you
Mr.
have
Chair,
exactly
we,
45 seconds
we,
left.
Yes, we have a somebody, a former senator and Chief John Harrington, who used to be a member of this committee, who was actually a very excellent member of this committee. I hated losing him. But
Chief Harrington.
Mr. Chair, John Harrington, currently Chief of Police for Metropolitan Transit Police, formerly Minnesota State Senator from District 67. 10, 15 years ago, I was the chair of the Minnesota Crime Victims Reparations Board. And as chair there, I got a chance to see the impact that crime and tragedy had on individuals. Over the course of my career there, I became clear that just simply giving financial reparations wasn't enough, but what victims really needed was emotional support. And I was tremendously gratified that when I became chief of police at St. Paul, Survivor Resources was there to support victims of some really horrific acts. The triple murder over on Rice Street, just absolutely horrific acts where the survivors are left behind trying to figure out how to make some sense of what's happened. In 2007, when the 35W bridge collapse went down, my next call, right after calling Tim Dolan to see what St. Paul PD could do to help in Minneapolis, was to call Margaret and to talk about how we're going to be able to support all those folks. And quite literally, they were the shoulder to support the victims that didn't get off those, that did get off the bridges, and the families of those that didn't. They were that ear to listen to those cries for help in the middle of the night when nobody else they thought cared. As the chief of police for Metro Transit, I have 8 county metro area jurisdictions. We spend an enormous amount of time in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, but are all over the metro area counties. And I can tell you that from train crashes up in Big Lake to arrests and citations and tragedies down in Rosemont, from the Minneapolis downtown area to St. Paul, that the need for survivor resources has never been greater. And I'm here to support this bill and hope that you will also.
Thank you so very much. See, that's how I know he's a great chief. He was timely as well. Thank you.
You said 45 seconds. I'm going to do what you want. So.
So I sincerely appreciate that. Just a couple questions for you, Senator Goodwin. My understanding is that there's been no state funding since 2008, and so can you give me a sense of where the funding has come from, since 2008 when there was no state involvement?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that, you know, outside of fundraisers and contributions that have kept a very, very scarce staff on so that they could keep going with their work, that is about all they've had to operate on. And I know that they are stretched very, very thin, and maybe I can get a quick answer, better answer for you.
We do get $66,000.
And will you identify yourself for the record,
I'm sorry,
please?
Margaret Maccabee. I'm the Executive Director of Survivor Resources.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do get a $66,000 grant from the Office of Justice Programs through the Crime Victim Service. But the rest of our money comes through individual donations and fundraiser events.
All right. Any other questions of the testifying, Senator Hall?
Hey, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure we could meet Ms. Maccabee, since she was talked about so much. So thanks for what you do.
Now, it's true that you guys really want to get me in trouble. Is that right?
Because the Senate, I don't know if they understand.
No. Okay. This is why. In the Senate, they say you're not supposed to be able to applaud or hold up any signs. So that's the second time. You guys really want to get me in trouble. This will be my last time
you're
chairing.
You're such a good chair.
No,
forgiving.
Thank you so very much. And we really do want to say thank you, Ms. Maccabee, for your work. And we appreciate it. With
thank
that,
I
am going to lay Senate file 210 over for possible inclusion. A couple more. Senator Sinjum. And then after Senator Sinjum, we will go to Senator Eaton, because I know she has to leave. And I know, Senator Sinjum, that you've been sitting there patiently and quiet, so I know you know of the 10-minute rule. And we will go to Senate file. You put the 1123.
Ready?
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a privilege to be here today to talk about Senate File 1123. I do have an amendment, though, if I could.
All right. If you give me one moment.
To match the bill up with the House, it's the A1 amendment, if somebody could offer it.
Give me 1 minute so I can find it. And I won't charge this time against you that's taking me to find this information. Hold on one moment. I don't have the amendment. Hold on one moment. Thank you so much. So the A1 amendment has been moved by Senator Hall. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted.
Okay. Thank you so much. Again, Mr. Chair, we'll make this quick. Senate File 1123 is what we might call proposes to create a lifesaver program in Minnesota. It's a program created by the Commissioner of Public Safety, or at least managed by that agency, would assist law enforcement agencies across Minnesota in terms of costs of developing a lifesaver program. And basically, a lifesaver program is a program wherein law enforcement agencies are equipped with the equipment and the training to seek out and find individuals who would perhaps be lost or missing, individuals that it could be an autistic child, it could be a individual with Alzheimer's or other illnesses that would cause that person to wander, if you will, and become lost or missing. These events happen, Mr. Chair and members, across the United States and, frankly, I suppose, across the world. And each time they do, they present law enforcement with very often tremendous hardship in terms of locating these individuals. And not infrequently, the final conclusion to these events is not what we'd hope for. So, Mr. Chair and members, I can kind of go through the bill. It talks about grant awards from up to initially $4,000 to a local unit of government from the standpoint of the police agency or county sheriff's department. Refiles or expansions, grants of $2,000. Then again, the grant award is not only the equipment, this is, by the way.
Senator Sijum, can you pull the mic a little closer to you, please?
That would.
Senator Sijum.
Yes.
Can you pull the mic closer to you, please?
I sure will. The grant would supply electronic finding equipment, if you will, the training and other needs associated with making this all work. Perhaps, Mr. Chair, it would be best if I just turned it over to Sergeant Kirby Long of the Youngstown County Sheriff's Department, who's actually worked with this equipment and this program firsthand. He, I think, can describe it far better than I.
Yes, sir. And please identify yourself for the record, please.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Kirby Long. I'm a sergeant with the Olmsted County Sheriff's Office with 25 years law enforcement experience. I'm joint team leader for the Olmsted County Sheriff's Office Rochester Police Department Project Lifesaver Search Team. Thank you for allowing me time to talk to you about this lifesaver technology. In 2007, Olmsted County Sheriff's Office Rochester Police Department teamed up with Brad and Joni Trayon, co-founders of the RT Autism Awareness Foundation, to bring Project Lifesaver to southeast Minnesota. Our team currently has 63 clients on the program, and we've had upwards of 75-plus clients at times, and ranging from young children to the elderly. Clients of the Young Lifesaver technology programs are friends, families, and neighbors that are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, autism, Down syndrome, dementia, and other cognitive conditions who have tendency to wander. Project Lifesaver uses a radio frequency transmitter with a set frequency which is worn on our client's wrist or ankle. The transmitter transmits its unique signal, or the frequency ID, once every second. If a client wanders from their caretaker, the caretaker then calls 911 reporting that the client on Project Lifesaver has gone missing, and patrol officers respond along with our search team members being paged out. Search team members respond to the scene using a receiver programmed with the client's specially assigned frequency, and while responding to the scene, we are searching for that signal. Once we get into the area, a coordinated search is established, and how we know when we start getting close enough to our client, we receive a unique chirp on our receiver. The transmitter worn by our clients transmit on ground level from 1 to 2 miles, and if a more extensive search is needed, we can send up air support to search from the air, and then we get about a 10 to 15 mile range to locate that signal. Costs for the program range from about $390 for the first year to approximately $43 per year after that. These receivers that our search team members use cost $1,500. And the batteries in our transmitters that our clients wear are changed out monthly. Our team consists of 21 certified search members, and the initial training of that search member consists of a two-day training, and then we train quarterly, having search scenarios during that time frame. We have had 19 call-outs since 2009 where the clients were located prior to our team's arrival, and we have had 4 saves using this technology with the client being located with the equipment. And we've also had several clients that were located before their caretaker even realized that their loved one had gone missing. Mm-hmm. Just briefly, if I could share a story. Back in September 2011, we had a 66-year-old gentleman that went missing on a rural farm outside of Rochester. He had some cognitive disabilities. He went missing for 53 hours. We had over 75 civilian volunteers, law enforcement agencies, fire departments, ambulance services, and the assistance of Minnesota State Patrol helicopter in searching for this gentleman. Finally, after 53 hours, this gentleman was found alive. And after that search, about 2 weeks later, the gentleman was found alive and went to the hospital. And when he got out, he went into an assisted living facility. But about 2 weeks after that incident, we conducted training. We put the transmitter that our clients wear, I put it in the exact location where that gentleman was found and laid it there and gave our search team members the exact scenario of what we had as responding officer to that incident. It took approximately 20 minutes for our team to receive signal, and it took approximately another half hour because of the train for our search team to get in to find the transmitter laying on the ground where the gentleman was found. So with that, I mean, our agency spent $20,000 plus in that 3-day search. And luckily enough, the gentleman was found alive, but a lot of times our loved ones who wander aren't found alive. And with that, I would just like to offer my support for this Lifesaver technology grant.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Long. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Any questions for the testifier?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
What is the financial request here?
Senator Sinsen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, we've left that blank. I think that if we could have our wish, it would be $350,000.
And
we're certainly willing to work with the committee.
And Senator Hall, it's my understanding from Fisco that that's not unusual sometimes for the appropriation to be open, and then it's up to the committee or the chair, Chair Latz, in order to determine if any amount, what amount can be allocated to that particular program.
Right.
Any other follow-up before I start asking some questions? Senator Sinsen, it's my understanding that you've had a chance to talk to Mr. Turner and others about some provisions of your bill that perhaps should be removed, or at least some consideration should be given. For an example, Subdivision 5 creates an account and, of course, some other work. And so it is our understanding or belief that that may be a cost driver. But I'll let Mr. Turner talk a little bit about that.
Mr. Chairman, members, Subdivision 5 creates a Lifesaver grant program account, its own account within the Department of Public Safety's budget. And I don't believe that that is needed. I think it's set up here to as a way to take in private donations. I think the donations would be better kept outside of the Department of Public Safety and be donated directly to the program. I don't think that account is needed. But any state money, of course, would flow in through the usual channels the Department of Office of Justice programs.
Senator St. Jim, what is your pleasure for Subdivision 5?
Mr. Chair, yes, Ms. Turner and I did talk about that. I, as I've gone through this bill, wondered about that myself. I would be amenable if the committee would remove Subdivision 5, and if it's altogether necessary, and if this bill makes it to conference committee, that can be talked about there.
All right. So Senator Hall? So it's moved that Subdivision 5, so lines 2.23 to 2.28 be removed from the bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion is adopted. Subdivision 5 is removed. Also, it's my understanding Subdivision 6, you should also consider removing it as it creates and drives costs, because there's a fiscal note that is somewhere around $23,000 as the bill sits right now. There's the possibility that by removing Subdivision 6 as well as Subdivision 8 would help in that from the fiscal perspective. But it's up to you, Senator Sinjum, what you would like to do about Subdivision 6 and Subdivision 8.
Mr. Chair, members, I would suggest, again, removing Subdivision 6 and Subdivision 8 and having that conversation in conference committee. It remains in the House, but if the bill makes it to conference committee, that conversation occurs.
So moved.
Senator Hall moves that we remove Subdivision 6 and Subdivision 8. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion is adopted. All right. So, Senator Sinjum, now the bill is in the shape that you would like. Any other questions for Senator Sinjum or the testifier? Seeing none, we will lay Senate File 1123 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you so much. Senator Eaton, and that would be Senate File number 1410. And if you give me just one quick second here so I can find 1410, that would be great. All right, Senator Eaton, I know that we had started by the time you got here, but I'm sure that you got the notice that we are only taking 10 minutes only. And with that being said, as soon as you start talking, we will start our wonderful clock. And thank you so much for being patient, because I know that you have some other obligations as well as your testifiers. So with that being said, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1410 is a bill to try and fund the bill that I passed last year for Steve's Law, and we're having hearing from a lot of different law enforcement areas and small towns that can't afford to get the program going in their communities. So we would like to try to provide some grants to take care of that. And I will let my testifiers elaborate.
Okay. Testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lexi Reed-Holtum, Vice President of the Steve Remler Hope Foundation, and thank you, committee members, for having us here today. For the Senate File 1410, I'm just going to give you some facts and talk kind of quickly, because I know you've all seen this information before, except for maybe Senator Hall. And Senator Hall, I remember from last year, I just wanted to thank you. You stood up on the floor of the Senate and spoke on behalf of Steve's Law, and that really made a difference. So I wanted to make sure that this is the first time I've seen you in committee that I thanked you for that. Mm-hmm. So in our state, we have some 33,000 first responders. Of those 33,000 first responders, we have 10,000, roughly 10,000 of those are peace officers. Of the peace officers in our state, since Steve's Law passed last year, less than 5% of them are carrying naloxone. What we see consistently across the board, and we've held meetings with the Sheriffs and Chiefs Association, the county attorneys, we've gone across the state and held meetings with various stakeholders and agencies throughout Minnesota, and the things that we've seen consistently is that they're concerned about funding dollars. And also, we know it to be true that there's still a stigma attached around addiction. that even if there is some education in the higher-ups, they're not necessarily rolling that knowledge down to the people that are on the streets. The first responders that are actually out there serving community are very undereducated. So not only are they not hearing naloxone, but they don't know about the law. So we're seeing that in situations where overdose deaths happen, that first responders are showing up and being completely unaware that the law has even passed. So not only do they not have it, but they can't save the life, and they don't know that the law is actually effective. So on that note, we are asking for these funding dollars to just be a kickstart to help our first responders have the money that they need. The Steve Rimmler Hope Foundation, we want you to know that we're taking responsibility for also making sure that we move it forward. So we have partnered with Dr. Satterley, and Dr. Satterley is willing to be the doctor who provides a standing order for any agency across the state that does not have a medical director, so that we don't have to spend those funding dollars for them to actually partner with a medical director. We're also willing to, under Dr. Satterley, create the training. Both of those things we are going to house on the Steve Rimmler Hope Foundation website and give away for free. So that's something that we can do to bring the budgetary dollars down. We know that Sheriff Stanek, in his training, he trained 23 officers. It cost him roughly around $10,000, $11,000. And a huge chunk of that money was just paying to have the training created and having a relationship with a medical director to oversee the standing order. And with that, I have a whole bunch of other stats that I can give you. Should you want them, I'm happy to do that. Specifically, numbers of deaths and the increases that we're still seeing across our state, the number of prescription opioids being distributed, and that 75% of new users are coming from trying prescription opioids and then slipping into the disease of addiction and going to heroin. But I think I'll just go ahead and turn it over to Dr. Satterley unless you have any questions for me now. Thank you.
All right, we'll go to Dr. Satterley, and then we'll ask questions afterwards. Dr. Paul Satterley, if you introduce yourself again for the record, and go from there.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson and committee members. Thank you for having me. My name is Paul Satterley. I'm an emergency physician, and I've been working in this community for 15 years after training in this community for 3 years. For a great majority of those years, I've been an educator, medical director, and of emergency medical services, including fire departments, police departments, and ambulance. And served on the state regulatory board for EMS. So I'm very comfortable talking about the process of education around our first responders and our ambulance providers. And I support this bill, and I thank you for letting us come and talk to you about this. The challenge with medical advances in any community in this state is that once you decide that this is a good idea, it could take up to 5 years for this to reach the extent of our state. And we don't think that taking 5 years to get naloxone out into the communities and into the first responders' hands is the right way to go about this. You know, what we hear from people is they've already set their education agendas, they've already set their budgets for the next year. And so the reason we're here in front of you is saying we'd like to ask the state to help us get around that process and provide the dollars to allow for the education and allow for the providing the medication. And I will say that this has been an important thing for me. It's really, you know, I don't have the familial connections, but my job as an emergency department physician in the metro, I work at numerous different facilities. You really see a challenge with this, and I think that this is the right direction for us to go. We just need to do it more quickly than the average uptake of a new medical technology or decision making.
Thank you, Doctor. I have a question that could be answered by either of you. So are there areas where the need is greater, or is it just even throughout the state? Ms. Holtum.
Lexi Reed Holtum. That is, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is on the third page of your packet, there's a little bit of a breakdown of demographics, but I'm happy to provide the committee with each county's numbers. There is a distinct difference between county and county where we see more overdose deaths happening, and we have partnered with MDH to get those statistics, and we are willing to say that it might be a wise idea to allow various dollar amounts to go to various regions according to how much they need it.
And I think you, Ms. Holden, really was getting at what I was looking at, because I see in the bill on line 1.10 that it talks about the money being distributed evenly, and I wasn't sure if that was your intent or whether the empirical data seems to suggest that the need is evenly across the state of Minnesota. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for pointing that out. I would be very happy to ask to have that deleted, the word evenly, if someone would make that motion.
Where is that?
That would be on line 1.10. Just strike the word evenly.
Well, we would just say that it needs to go to all of them.
I can move that.
Yeah. All right. So there's a motion by Senator Hall to delete the word evenly on line 1.10. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifiers? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who could answer this, but first off, is there an expiration date for naloxone? There is.
Senator?
Yeah, Dr. Satterlee.
Dr.
Paul Satterlee. The manufacturer says that there's a shelf life of 2 years for that particular medication.
Okay. And then second
Hall.
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the doctor, Hennepin County, if I have this right, spent $11,000 and trained 23 people. That seems like a lot of money to me. Does it need to have that much money for that many? Yeah, any thoughts on that, how many you can train with how much money?
Dr. Satterlee.
So again, Dr. Paul Satterlee, thank you for the question. Absolutely, I agree that that's an unbelievable number. And I don't work for Hennepin County. I don't have inside information as to what happened to that training, but I'm confident that we could train far more people for that kind of money if we did it differently. I think that there's some speculation that maybe there was other training rolled into that, like CPR training, which is not part of what we would do with naloxone. But we've talked about recognizing the importance of a limited budget, about how we could reach the greatest number of people, particularly in the rural parts of Minnesota, where we're not going to be able to go out and have, you know, nightly meetings with everybody. So we'll have to be creative using technology, but I'm very confident we can train a significant number of people for far less money than that.
And one last one,
Senator
Mr.
Hall.
Chair, and to the doctor again. How many hours of training is needed for typical?
Dr. Satterlee.
Yep. Should I introduce myself each time? Or how? Okay, yes. So Dr. Paul Satterlee, thank you. I'm confident, and again, I've trained people for 15 years, that we can easily train somebody on how to use this in 1 hour.
Okay.
Any other questions? Any other questions for the testifier? Senator Eden, any last words?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to add that one of the things that's kind of appalled me is that when we do have law enforcement or whoever showing up on the scene, they're not aware of the naloxone, so they're confiscating it, thinking it's another drug at the scene. So then the people who would be around those who would need it are losing their access to the naloxone. So the education piece is just crucial.
Okay. Well, Senator Eden, thank you for your words, and thank you for the bill. With that being said, we will now lay Senate file number 1410 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
And now I see Senator Jensen. Senator Jensen. And that would be Senate file 512. And if you give me just one quick second, I'll make sure I got the information here. All right. And Senator Jensen, I know you just joined us, but I'm sure you read the chief author's announcement saying that said that there's a limit of 10 minutes. And we just want to make sure that we fairly warn everyone of that. And we thank you for being here and thank you for all that you do. So with that,
thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chair.
Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This Senate File 512 establishes a grant program for child advocacy centers that assist victims of abuse and their families. Child advocacy centers in Minnesota, they offer a safe place for people, children, teens, and vulnerable adults who may have experienced sexual abuse, physical abuse, sexual exploitation, or witnessed a violent crime. So organizations may apply for these grants. to develop or establish child advocacy centers and existing centers can apply to expand or enhance services. Currently, there are 7 in Minnesota, and you should have a map in your packet. It would be my goal to try to get access for every county, the victims and families in every county, access to a child advocacy center, but this bill doesn't even come close to that. But what it does do is it provides funding for communities to explore whether or not they want to provide the opportunity to develop a new center or expand a regional center. And as you can see on the map, there is a lot of space and a lot of area that it's not accessible to them. Child advocacy centers coordinate the investigation, the treatment, and management of abuse cases and provide direct services to children and vulnerable adults, like I said. So the grants can be used for things like mental health, medical examinations, advocacy for victims and families, specialized training for child advocacy center staff and teams, and for something called a forensic interview. Now, when I went and visited the Mayo Clinic Children's Advocacy Center in Rochester, I knew right then that day that I had to do all I could to advocate for this process and for get some resources so that families can have access. What a forensic interview. Well, when you first get there, the building is safe. It's locked. You feel very safe as a victim and as a family member. And you go in, and they have these forensic interview rooms that are set up like your living room. They're very comfortable, and I would feel comfortable having my child there. And there's one interviewee that does the interview, and they're hooked up with an earpiece. And then there's another room adjacent that has circuitry available so that everyone on what's called an interdisciplinary team has access to that interview at the same time. So everyone involved hears the same thing, sees the same things, and then they have the ability to hold a discussion and try to, and they can contact the interviewee. For instance, ask this because of something they saw or heard. And that child then only has one interview during the process, unless another one is warranted, and sometimes it is. Each one is individual. But at least that is available within that child advocacy center. Now, any public or private organization can apply to try to get and put in an application. So this isn't just for child advocacy centers that are there. This is to provide any public or private organization the ability to do this. But they have to do certain things. They have to have, it has to be comfortable, private setting, a good program, policies in place, and you can read the rest in the bill. And an evaluation in process is also important. The one that I think I want to point out for sure is the policies and practices that involve culturally competent use of procedures and investigative procedures to make sure that that is also included in there. So what we're asking for is $1.5 million in 2016, $1.5 million in 2017, some money to go to the Children's Alliance, which I have someone here to talk from that organization. So with that, if it's okay, I would introduce Marsha Milliken from the Minnesota Children's Alliance.
Welcome, and if you'll say your name again for the record and go forward. Thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Marsha Milliken. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Children's Alliance, which is a coalition of children's advocacy centers and multidisciplinary teams. I'm testifying in support of Senate File 512, which is a bill that would provide funding for accredited children's advocacy centers to expand and augment services, funding for communities to develop children's advocacy centers where needed, and funding for statewide training, technical assistance, and capacity building through our coalition. In 2013, over 5,000 child abuse reports were made to Child Protections. Those were only Child Protection reports. That doesn't include the child abuse cases reported to law enforcement that were committed by someone other than a family member. Currently, research suggests that 1 in 10 children will be sexually abused before turning 18. And you have a handout that shows prevalence, which is based on the 2010 census. When you look at each county and realize the number of kids who could be victims of just sexual abuse, it's staggering. That doesn't include physical abuse, sexual exploitation, neglect, or witness to a violent crime such as domestic violence, which are also cases that we handle. Prior to Children's Advocacy Centers, children would travel from professional to professional, having one interview after another throughout the investigation process, and to receive services such as therapy or counseling. Realizing that that re-traumatized children every time they had to retell what happened to them, Children's Advocacy Centers were developed. The first one was developed in Huntsville, Alabama. Children's Advocacy Centers are grounded in a multidisciplinary team approach that incorporates the specialized fact-finding, non-leading forensic interview, medical exams for collecting evidence, trauma-informed mental health services, and so that families can begin the healing process, and family support services and advocacy to help connect families with the services they need during a life-altering time. They also coordinate multidisciplinary teams so that they can ensure cases are regularly reviewed by a team and kids don't fall through the cracks. Today, there are over 800 children's advocacy centers in the United States and other countries. Minnesota has only 7. We are wanting to ensure that kids can receive these services when they stay by staying in their own community. The multidisciplinary team approach within child advocacy centers is effective and is supported by research. Although some aspects of a multidisciplinary team approach can exist without a facility, a supportive child-focused facility is fundamental to the Children's Advocacy Center. The location is designed to create a sense of safety and security for the victim. We know that child abuse is the primary source of trauma in children's lives that can affect them their entire life, both as children and well into adulthood. Early intervention helps children begin the healing process so they can have happier childhoods, which lead to healthier adults. Children's advocacy centers exemplify the best aspects of our society's efforts to protect our most vulnerable citizens through collaboration, responsiveness, and innovation. We ask that you support Senate File 512.
Thank you. Senator Jensen, your next testifier. We have roughly 2 minutes and 30 seconds left.
Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Ostrom. I'm the Olmsted County Attorney.
Welcome.
I'm also a member of the Minnesota County Attorney Association Board of Directors. I speak on behalf of the board and the County Attorney Association also. On July 12, 2011, the Olmsted County Board approved a resolution creating the Child Advocacy Center multidisciplinary team. This team was established pursuant to Minnesota Statute Section 626.558. This was the first step in our journey to establish the Male Child and Family Advocacy Program, our Child Advocacy Center. Today, nearly all victims involving a report of child sexual abuse are interviewed at our CAC. All interested agencies come together to provide one interview for the victim in an effort to maximize the forensics interview and greatly reduce the further trauma a child may experience. The Child Advocacy Center is more than just the team. Our MDT was formally established in 2011, but the center did not officially open for another 2 years. While the team is the heart and soul of the interview, the center itself provides a calm, non-threatening atmosphere for victims. Already a very stressful and scary time, bringing a child to a police station or a hospital is additionally traumatic. In 2014, our CAC did 69 sex abuse multidisciplinary team interviews and an additional 5 physical abuse interviews. The formation of an MDT and the relationships is a process, and we agreed in the beginning to limit our MDT interviews to sexual assault and only the very egregious physical abuse cases. On the one hand, it might seem like 69 interviews for a county the size of Olmsted is low, but it represents 69 kids who were reported a form of sexual assault. Many of those were substantiated. 69 kids were able to share that event in a comfortable environment that was non-judgmental and where additional services could be accessed for their benefits. 69 kids is too many.
Senator Jensen, you have 30 seconds.
If possible, I would like my parent testifier to say a few words.
That's fine. Go ahead. I can respond to questions.
We might ask some questions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I'll just try to cut to the chase. I am a beneficiary of these services in Duluth, Minnesota. One of their organizations is First Witness. And I'm a single mom now of 4 children ages 9 and under. And when our silence was finally broken of the life we endured at the hands of their father, First Witness was there. They gave my children a safe place to talk about the scary secrets they held inside. As the mother facing her own wounds, they were there for me as I had to face the discovery of even more pain that my kids had lived through. Breaking free from the darkness of domestic abuse and sexual abuse is a scary journey, and walking out the doors of First Witness could have felt like walking off the edge of a cliff, but it wasn't. First Witness doesn't close the door behind you and wish you luck. No, they hold your hand, and they help you find the resources you need to start the journey of healing. They advocate for you and help guide you through the confusing maze of the judicial system. You know, they comforted me through the devastation. They walked with me through the courthouse halls. They have sat with me through hearings. They have stood with me when I have had to face our abuser. They have listened to me when I have needed to be heard. They have encouraged me when the system seems to fail. They have nurtured and educated my children on their right to be safe and have helped them find their voice. So my journey is not complete. I'm still trying to complete a divorce and prevent him from having further contact. But I know that I can go to First Witness anytime to seek counsel or understanding. And had I not had this resource, I would have lost one of the core support systems that have helped me to continue to keep my family safe. So as you consider this bill, I just ask you to consider what you would want for the loved ones in your life if they were facing sexual abuse or child abuse. If you'd want them to be heard, supported, protected, given a voice, and advocated for, then you would want them to have services like children advocacy centers such as First Witness. Thanks.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And your name is?
Kelly Nelson.
Kelly Nelson?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Couple questions, and perhaps Senator Jensen, excuse me. Yes, Senator Jensen can answer the question. I'm thinking of Sinjum and Jensen, so that's what was getting me confused. I see that the appropriation amount is $1.5 million for fiscal year 16 and $1.5 in fiscal year 17. So does that include monies for the Minnesota Children's Alliance? Because I heard you talking about that, and I do see on line 3.9 that there's $150,000 set aside. Or is that in addition to, or does it include that money in the 1.5 ask?
Mr. Chair, the $150,000 is included in the 1.5.
All right. And can you tell me how this particular child advocacy center differs from Corner House, because I know that there is a well-known entity called Corner House that's used in criminal or for criminal purposes, and how these two differ.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Jensen.
So I understand your question. There is another entity out there that's called Corner House, and how do the current child advocacy centers, because they're all different?
Yeah.
So they would be, each child advocacy center is set up, they have to have the same and accredited through the Minnesota Children's Alliance, but they're set up for what's in their community. So they are different. They're not the same.
If I could address this, too, my name is Mark Osterman, Olmsted County Attorney.
Yes.
Our model in Olmsted County is a medical model. That's a model that the Corner House does not have. They don't have the medical provider on site available to do those medical exams if appropriate. That's one of the key differences. Corner House is also a forensics interview technique. We use Corner House to train our interviewers, but the model I think we're all looking for is to incorporate that medical piece along with it. And I know that that's a portion of the money that is hoped to be gained in this bill.
So to the testifiers, so will this particular center's interviews that may have a criminal overtone, will that interview be available for prosecution of an individual? And if so, is it recorded both audio and video?
That's the cornerstone of the entire concept, is that we do one interview that incorporates and encapsulates all the interests of all the entities. So it's not only a law enforcement interview for criminal prosecution process, but it's also a child protection interview that it provides child safety and family safety, and it also gathers a certain amount of information for the medical provider to understand if and how a medical exam is appropriate. As indicated, we make one interview instead of three in that case. We lower the traumatization to the child, and by incorporating this type of an interview, especially using the video and audio recording capabilities, and the ability to send questions into the interviewer, we can get all of this information gathered in one interview and be the most child-friendly and less traumatic as possible.
And it's my understanding, Senator Jensen, that this is the first time that you guys have that this particular proposal has come before the state? And if so, can you give me a sense of what is their budget and their past funding source?
Mr. Chair, I would like to have Marsha Milliken from the National Children's Alliance come up and speak to those specific questions.
Thank you, Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, yes, this is the first time this type of bill has come forward. Currently, there are three children's advocacy centers that do receive some funding from the Office of Public Safety, but not all of them receive any funding from Public Safety. And the Minnesota Children's Alliance received a one-time grant from Public Safety, but they are not in the ongoing funding cycle for Public Safety. Children's Advocacy Centers also, some of them receive money from counties, some from cities. Some have private partnerships with a hospital, for example. They also are involved in fundraising activities. One of our Children's Advocacy Centers, 40% of their funding comes from fundraising and public donations.
Any other questions for the testifier? Senator Jensen?
So, Mr. Chair, when I started this, like I said, and understood what the process was, I talked to my counties, and every one of them were interested in trying to be able to utilize and have access to this type of a system, and that's what this money is asking for, is so that those communities that want to participate and have that available for the victims and the families in their communities, they can get some grant money to be able to establish, or somewhat another center that's already established in another area, set up a regional center. So I hope you look at this from that angle, that this isn't just to supply money for ones that are currently there, which it would, but the main thing is to make sure we get some of these satellites and regional centers to other areas of the state, since we have so few currently.
And lastly, I know that Mr. Ostrom was talking about 69 interviews. And is that the totality of the number of interviews that were realized this past fiscal year? And I'm sure he can appreciate my question, because I'm sure he wanted to complete his thought there.
Thank you. As I was talking earlier, we did 69 interviews in 2014, and we were very deliberate about the cases that we took. As I said, this is a process. Getting a multidisciplinary team together and choosing the right cases is important. We did 69 cases in 2014. In the first quarter of 2015, we've already done 27 for Olmsted County. We've also done 9 courtesy interviews for surrounding counties, and that's the beauty of this regional concept, is to bring in counties that are close by geographically and to be able to share this resource. So already in 2015, we're well ahead of the pace we had for 2014. And we're also starting to reach out to other surrounding counties, which is key to this whole concept.
All right. With that, thank you so much, because there are no further questions. Thank you, Senator Jensen. And with that, Senate File 512 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. And with that, we are going to Senator Dibble, Senate File 1590. And Senator Dibble, I'm sure that you probably got the notice from us that we're trying to keep everyone.
Timer right there.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. I should have known that you had it already prepared. And thank you for being here, and thank you for all that you do. So with that being said, the floor is yours, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1590 would create a grant program for the purpose of extending the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative in the state of Minnesota. Just very quickly, what that is exactly is a number of years ago, it became abundantly clear that our juvenile justice system was not working in the way that we would hope, our system as it relates to juveniles when they interact with it is arbitrary, expensive, discriminatory, ineffective. And an initiative was undertaken by the Annie E. Casey Foundation to see where good interventions might might be most effective. And it was thought that taking a look at detention in the early phase of the juvenile court process would be best. It was found through research that placing juveniles in a locked detention center pending court significantly increases the odds that youth will be found delinquent, committed to corrections facilities, and seriously damage their prospects for future success. Even if these juveniles themselves pose very little threat to public safety. So they undertook grant making, and they engaged a number of states, eventually came to Minnesota a number of years ago, I think back in 2006 originally, with a few counties, working with them, using several best practices, relying on 8 key factors. And I'll just go over those very quickly, and those are also described in the language of the bill if you look on lines 1.23. Collaboration between local juvenile court, probation agencies, prosecutors, defenders, and other governmental entities to create formal partnerships to cooperatively plan, implement, and assess detention reforms. Collection and utilization of data to diagnose system problems, assess impacts of reforms, assure that decisions and policies are grounded in facts rather than myth or anecdote. Objective admission screenings to identify which youth actually pose public safety risks, which should be placed in alternative programs. And on that note, Mr. Chair, I'll say that this work is very, very complementary to the work of YIPA that you heard about earlier, in which kids should just simply be sent home. Non-secure alternatives to detention targeted to youth who would otherwise be locked up, also making sure they're in their neighborhoods where they're connected to their communities. Case processing reforms, expediting the flow of cases through the system, and making sure that we have policies and practices to deal with special detention cases, violations of probation, failures to appear in court, trying to improve appearance in courts, et cetera, especially for those who pose a minimal threat to public safety, because sometimes that triggers automatic detention, again, defeating our goals. Persistent determined attention to combating racial disparities, careful study to identifying specific strategies to eliminate bias, ensure a level playing field for kids of color, and in those instances where secure detention is warranted, making sure that those facilities are safe and appropriate and good care is provided in those settings. And so very quickly, we are asking for $5 million over the biennium, for the purpose of funding an organization that can then work collaboratively with the counties that have now expressed interest in implementing JDAI initiatives, and continue to fund those that have come on recently. Last year, as you recall, we provided a little bit of state money. Most of the dollars that flow to counties through OJP for JDAI come through federal funds presently, and also Annie Casey has provided some money as well. There are a number of counties that don't have the resources to begin this reform, such as Carver, Scott, Stearns, Kendi, Ojai, Anoka, Washington, Morrison, Aitkin, Sherbourne, Chippewa, and others. What these dollars would cover site coordinator salaries, training, state technical assistance, model site visits, alternatives to detention, annual conferences, risk assessment, instrument development, validation, decision point analysis. And the idea is that eventually that kind of county-specific support would taper off over time, because as these practices are taken up and implemented and instituted and made a part of the system, these counties realize fairly significant budget savings of their own and just can incorporate these practices into their own budgets. So you see, I described Section 1, the goals: eliminate unnecessary use of secure detention, minimize rearrest and failure to appear in court rates, appropriate conditions of confinement in secure facilities, reducing racial and ethnic disparities. And then we set forth some of the grant criteria using the Annie E. Casey 8 points, providing the training and technical support, et cetera. There's a requirement then, starting in paragraph B, line 2.7, that the grant recipient must match those dollars from private sector funds, and making sure that portion of the grant goes directly to counties for implementation of juvenile detention reforms, not just to the organization that's going to provide the technical support, and then making sure that there's great distribution of these dollars across the state of Minnesota, and that we also have an evaluation of how well we're doing with these dollars. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Smith, who will share some additional thoughts.
Welcome, Mr. Smith. If you'll identify yourself for the record and go forward with your testimony, and you have roughly 3 minutes and 30 seconds left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Smith, and I'm the state coordinator for JDAI, the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. Senator Dibble pretty much summed up all of my testimony. I knew he knew the initiative well, but he knows it better than I even thought. And so I do not, literally, he talked about almost everything that I had to talk to you guys about today. However, I did want the committee to know that although JDAI by the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee is considered to be the most successful juvenile justice reform effort to ever take place in Minnesota. However, along with that, JDAI has had significant reductions in average daily population in detention centers, detention numbers going down, crime rates going down, an additional 8 to 10 points more so than they've come down nationally in JDAI jurisdictions. However, in Minnesota, our numbers, and you have the graphs in front of you, have even been better than the national average in JDAI sites as well. And so in the aggregate, and that includes Hennepin County, where we're in Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Dakota County, the Arrowhead. We've also opened up Rice County with the funds that the legislature gave us 2 years ago. You gave us $100,000 to begin to open up additional counties and expand, and Rice County was the first one to sign on. And we're currently going through our conversations now with Olmsted County and trying to finish up everything to have them do a contract. And that's in addition to all the other counties that would like to be involved. However, I'm the state coordinator, and I've been working in all these sites with no help until recently in November, where we were able to hire an assistant state coordinator with the funds that you gave us. And we also get help from the Office of Justice Programs with a staff person who helps us on quite a bit of the things that we do. But we need those funds to also have more technical assistance support to open up the other sites. I can't be in 20 jurisdictions in Minnesota to do the work. But in the aggregate, with all the counties that we're currently working in, we have our total admissions are down by 66% in the state, when the average is 44 for the nation in jurisdictions in JDAI. Our average daily population in our detention centers are down by 61%. The youth of color admissions are down by 60%. The average daily population of youth of color in our state is down by 47%. And also, our crime rates, I'm sorry, I made a mistake in what I quoted. Our crime rates have fallen by an additional 5 to 8 percentage points below the national average in JDI jurisdictions, while in Minnesota's JDI jurisdictions, the crime rate has fallen between 8 and 12 points below the national average. So it's working. We have a lot of people who are interested. It's just that we don't have the resources available to offer technical assistance and get the county started the way we'd like. And so that's why we're here today.
All right. Thank you so very much, Mr. Smith. A couple questions for you. So that was right on. I saw you push that button there. I did see that at line, that 2.7 line, Senator Dibble, that there's a match, or the grant recipient must match at least $100,000 of the grant amount, dollar for dollar, with money from private sectors. Can you tell us why that line is there and what you see as the significance of that?
Well, Mr. Smith knows better than I, but I would venture that the rationale is that it creates some skin in the game, some effort on the part of the entity that's going to be providing some of this some of these services.
That's in essence, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Smith.
that's in essence why we, when we approached the legislature 2 years ago, we drew that language in to, so that we could show that there was skin in the game. And we also had philanthropic partners who were very interested in supporting the effort outside of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, but they wanted to know what the commitment was from the state of Minnesota and the Office of Justice Programs. And once they found out what that was, they in turn said, we give you $100,000 a year for the next 2 years, and they've just done the same thing. And we're also looking at additional partners who are willing to give us money, and the Annie E. Casey Foundation has, the state of Minnesota has been really close to being what's considered a model site through the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And in being a model site, what would happen is they would also have us be a place where other states who are interested in the work would visit, get trained, learn how to do it, and then they would fund us at about $150,000 to $200,000 a year to put that training on. And so we just think that if we can expand our effort, that what they've told us to expand our effort is also one of the things that we need to do to be a model site, and not just in a couple of rural areas and in the metro.
And the past investment that we have put forth from the state, was it $100,000?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, I know what a juvenile detention center is. What's an alternative detention center?
Senator Dibble, or to the testifier?
Well, Mr. Chair, the alternative is the alternative to detention. Mr. Smith can talk. You know, some of it is some of the YPA programming that goes on, some of the youth intervention work that goes on. Mm. Sometimes it's just understanding that a child is not a threat to public safety, and they can just be sent home pending their trial. So alternatives to detention is the idea, and Mr. Smith can answer with more precision.
And if I might, Senator Hall, what also happens is that this particular initiative helps to create instruments that judges and those who are in court, they have an opportunity to look at. So that's a risk assessment instrument. And so with that instrument, it helps to make sure that individuals who should not just be in detention, that's juvenile detention, mm-hmm. just being housed there, are released. And there's some other mechanism that they could be released on, be it electronic home monitoring or release, you know, to their parent or something like that, as opposed to what was happening in the past, unfortunately, is that young people were just being relegated to the detention center. And the thought is, if you're constantly in those settings and you're mixing, mm-hmm. Low-level offenders with those who are a little more sophisticated, then that has the potential to criminalize that particular young person. And I hope I answered the question. But
so, Mr. Chair,
Senator Smith,
if I could respond to you.
Senator Hall.
My question then is, this is a lot of money, $5 million, that we're putting in to not have kids go into detention, to have them do what? So help me out, Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, I can give you an example of some of the alternatives that have been developed and why they're used. So, for example, as Senator Champion mentioned with the risk assessment instrument, an example would be you score from 0 to 15. If you score between a 0 and a 7, outright release to home, you show up to court, see a judge. Between 0 to 14, you meet an alternative. And this is a data-driven initiative, and so we develop the alternatives based on the data that we collect about who comes to our detention centers. And so if you score between a 7 and a 14 and you meet the eligibility for a detention alternative, depending on what type of offense you committed, you could go to an evening reporting center. And you have to report there until you show up to court. You could go to community coaches. These are things that we've developed where somebody checks in with you every day to make sure that you're.
So if I could interrupt you, Mr.
Yes, sir.
Are we paying for the coaches and for these other senators or centers?
No. The way that
Mr.
Chair, Senator Hall, the alternatives are paid for through cost savings. We're not asking the legislature to pay for the alternatives. So an example is in Hennepin County, once you got a reduction in the number of young people going to the juvenile detention center, those cost savings were then reinvested into community alternatives, which at $321.11 a day in the Hennepin County Detention Center, you are now able to pay for a variety of community alternatives that ensure kids came to court, that they didn't get in trouble in the meantime, and that it was much cheaper, a fraction of the cost, at actually about $65 a day, and you got better outcomes and didn't risk putting low-level kids in with more sophisticated kids when all of them get out and we don't want to risk criminalizing them all and making us all less safe by putting kids in detention who don't need to be there, and we get better outcomes, and it's a fraction of the cost.
So, Mr. Chair?
I think Senator Dibble wants to respond.
I'm going
to
ask Senator Dibble a question. So, Senator Dibble, what are we paying $5 million for?
Senator Dibble.
Oh, thank you. So, specifically, the dollars cover site coordinator salaries. So, you know, all folks who are out across the state working with these specific counties, training, so developing training programs for, you know, all these officials who are working in the juvenile justice system, as well as community-based folks. You know, so there's this pretty large collaboration. State technical assistance, so that's, as it's described, some of the money, some of the efforts that Brian goes to, some of the effort that OJP goes to. Model site visits, so there's, of course, bringing folks in to take a look at how great things are going in St. Louis County or other places, or a little bit of travel and that sort of thing. Alternatives to detention, so some of these dollars will, in fact, help with the startup of some of these alternatives, whether it's the coaches, the daily check-in, the electronic monitoring, helping support some of these local community-based YIPA-type programs, annual conferences, developing this risk assessment tool that takes time, staff effort, developing it, validating it with research and analysis, making sure everything is data-driven, decision point analysis, all of these things cost some dollars. The savings that Mr. Smith talked about do occur over a period of time, so these grant dollars would slowly phase out on a county-by-county basis. Because the savings are quite real. These are actual beds in the detention facilities that get retired. And as we all probably know, especially folks on this committee know, secure facilities are really, really expensive on a daily basis. So the alternatives are a lot less expensive. I know in Dakota County, they've actually opened their beds up and are contracting with other counties and are actually making some dollars, and in turn, these savings can be in turn used and plugged back into all of these initiatives, the community-based services, and all of the services that go into creating these alternatives.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
How many FTEs are we talking that this $5 million works with? Employees, staff
Mr.
members.
Smith.
Oh, well, it depends on the counties, actually. We do know for certain that it goes into a researcher in each county, the JDAI, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, the JDAI coordinator in each site, researchers, and then usually people bring in more technical assistance to help with the validation studies, the risk assessment instruments, and things like that. And so the FTEs may vary depending on how the size of the county, how many people are necessary to be involved. So, for instance, in Dakota County, in Ramsey County, you have the coordinator, you have the research person there, then you pull people. There's a lot of people because all of the stakeholders involved, county attorneys, public defenders, corrections, judges.
Are they taking their salaries out of this $5 million?
No, the only people who would,
Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, the only people who would, that we've put in our system to take their salaries out of it, would be the state the JDAI coordinator for that site, and the researcher, as well as if we bring on other counties, we have to have technical assistance providers from the state to also begin to do the work with them and get them up to speed and start to institutionalize the initiative. And so right now we're looking at a complement of one FTE per three counties. And so that's also
So let me suggest this mm-hmm. so that the testifier has an opportunity to think about your question as well, because I understand that it does depend on a number of different variables, but I'm sure he can submit some additional information us as to if you did receive the entire ask, what would your dream be when it comes to that money and the number of FTEs? Is that acceptable,
yep,
Senator Hall?
Very much.
All right,
thanks.
Mr. Smith, so if you would be so kind as to do that would be helpful. If there's no other questions, unless you have any closing comments, Senator Dibble, or are you okay?
No, Mr. Chair, but I did want to, like I said earlier, put in my plug for YIPA. I wasn't the chief author of the YIPA initiative this year, but this is very complimentary to that, and I'm a big champion and supporter. These two work very much in tandem. So if you could give favorable consideration to their request from earlier as well.
Thank you, Senator Dibble, for all that you do, and thank you for being here today. And with that being said, we will lay Senate File 1590 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All right. I want to say openly and publicly how thankful I am to Judge Smalls, who's been very patient, because his bill was supposed to go very first because I'm the author of that bill. But I thought we should probably get through these others so that we would have the time on the tail end, and also Kevin there. So thank you so much. We are almost home. Let me just say, we're almost home. So with that being said, if Senator Kent is here, Senator Kent. Okay. Hey, Senator Kent. So we will take up Senate File 1489 first. And Senator Kent, I'm sure you probably got the message in the word about the 10-minute. There you go. Thank you so very much. And Senator Kent, I do appreciate your patience and the patience of your testifiers as well. That's why I like being very timely, because I know that there are people who are waiting, and I just think it's only fair that we keep everyone as focused as possible and moving forward. And with that being said, once you start, we start our clock.
She's stalling.
Now I'm starting. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for being here, for hearing Senate File 1489 today. I want to thank you for this opportunity. Senate File 1489 is a bill that would build on an important first step that the legislature began in 2014 to prevent sexual assaults. A preliminary grant program was created at that time, and Senate File 1489 seeks an expansion of these grants, as well as establishing statutory language defining the purpose of the program as being intended to support primary prevention. I would like to begin by examining the scope of sexual assault in Minnesota. The Department of Health estimates that 61,000 Minnesotans are victims of sexual assault annually. Minnesota invests significant resources to provide support services for victims, to investigate and prosecute crimes, and to house and to treat offenders. But until last year, Minnesota invested zero general fund dollars for primary prevention to stop assaults before they occur. We changed that with the appropriation of $300,000 in annual funding to establish a grant program to address primary prevention of sexual assault. Now we are here hoping to build on this success. The program enacted in 2014 was based on the success of the Champion Communities Demonstration Grant Program that the Office of Justice Programs piloted from 2012 to 2014 with the support of a one-time federal grant funds. The Champion Communities Demonstration Grant Program was based on the successful SMART team model that Minnesota developed to improve response to victims by developing interdisciplinary networks. And bills introduced last year made it possible to extend the one-time Champion Communities Demonstration Grants to support development of networks throughout the state. The first grants were awarded last fall to start networks in 5 communities, and a copy of the RFP that describes the program is included in the committee members' packets. To review Senate File 1489 very briefly, because it's pretty straightforward, in Section 1, we establish the purpose for the program in statute. In other words, we clearly define the purpose for this grant program to support community initiatives intended to prevent initial perpetration or victimization of sexual assault. And Section 2 increases annual funding for the program by $200,000 per year, $400,000 for the biennium, and with this increase, the annual funding for the program would be $500,000.
I am pleased to introduce our testifiers in support of Senate File 1489, Yvonne Cornoyer. I knew I was going to mess it up, even though she told me. the Prevention Program Coordinator with MnCASA, and Jean Renane, the Executive Director of MnCASA. Thank you so much.
All right. To your first testifier, would you like Ms. Cornoyer to go first?
Sure.
Okay. And if you'll say your name again for the record, because we know we just sliced it up, so we just wanted to be stated accurately, and then proceed with your testimony.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Yvonne Cornoyer, and I'm the Prevention Program Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I'm joined by Jean Ronane, who will also be available to answer questions. MnCASA is Minnesota's voice for victims and survivors, rape crisis centers, and allies who are committed to ending sexual violence. We provide training and services to our over 60 member programs based throughout the state. Our prevention work focuses on preventing sexual violence before anyone is ever harmed and before anyone acts in a sexually inappropriate or a harmful way towards another. The purpose of this bill is to provide statutory language for a program that was established in 2014 through the budget process and to appropriate $200,000 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Safety for Sexual Assault Primary Prevention Grants. In 2014, when the legislature approved the appropriation of $300,000 in the public safety budget, it was to be distributed to grants to sexual assault advocacy programs for supplemental community primary prevention partnership grants. While the funding was established, the legislature didn't clearly articulate through statute the policy intention of this funding, and that's what this bill does. The bill language clarifies that grants will address primary prevention, which prevents the initial perpetration or initial victimization of sexual assault. There's a complete and detailed description of the theoretical and evidence-informed basis of focusing on primary prevention in the community primary prevention partnerships request for application that's been provided to you. At its core, this program really provides communities with necessary resources to create an approach that addresses the risk factors that are most important or most prevalent in their community so that they can have the greatest impact in creating a community where no one is sexually assaulted anymore. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
We'll ask questions right at the end, so if you'll stay with us, that would be great.
Okay.
And so to the next testifier, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Jean Ronane, Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I haven't prepared additional testimony. You'll hear me testify very shortly about grants for crime victim services as well. So what I will add to what Ms. Cornoyer already spoke to is that our requests for primary prevention grants are predicated on the strong crime victim services programs are also available, and that, in fact, these same programs are the programs that are implementing the primary prevention programs that we're here to speak about. So one really predicates on the other, and that we need to have strong crime victim services programs in order for those same programs to deliver these prevention programs. And it's very important to have the language as well in this statute. So thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. And with that, I have a couple questions, Senator.
Mr. Chair?
Oh.
Do we have another testifier? Ms. Richards going to be testifying? No?
For the next bill. This is just for 1489 is my understanding that these are only testifiers.
Thank you. Sorry. Okay.
So it's my understanding that MnCASA currently gets a base funding of $300,000 or half of $300,000 each fiscal year. And so is this request an additional $200,000 or an additional $400,000 over the biennium? Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could somebody explain? I know as I read this on 1.8, but there's probably other places too, it talks about sexual assault primary prevention services. I know what a sexual assault prevention service would be. What's primary? What is that word there for?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, primary prevention really focuses on how do we prevent sexual violence before it ever happens. So one of the ways that we do that is really focusing on changing policies, practices, and the environments in communities and society that lead to or that increase the risk that someone will choose to sexually assault or sexually harm. So primary prevention really looks at sexual violence. Instead of focusing on the individual and what an individual can do, it focuses on what can we in communities do to change the factors that lead to such high rates of sexual violence.
So could you give me
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me a similar word instead of primary? What else could I put in there so I...
Sometimes primary prevention is... Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Hall. Sometimes primary prevention is referred to as universal prevention, so it's prevention that goes across the entire population. So primary prevention is a public health term, so it sometimes think is not very familiar to people, but it's the things that we like eating well is a primary prevention strategy, or policies, you know, for example, that changed the allowing of smoking in public places. That's a policy that's aimed at changing the nature and across the whole universe. Is that helpful?
Any additional questions, Senator Hall?
No, I think that's good. Thank you.
Any last comments on this particular bill, Senator Kent?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Basically, I think we've covered it all. As everyone says, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It's real common sense kind of stuff. And if we can avoid having people become victims, if perpetrators can avoid getting into this position in the first place, it keeps lives whole, and that's what really matters.
Well, thank you, Senator Kent. And with that being stated, Senate File 1489 is laid on the table for possible inclusion in Omnibus Bill. Senator Kent, I'm sure you're going to remain with us for Senate File 332. And as you all are getting ready, I would like to acknowledge seeing my good friend Cynthia Elmore that's here. And I know that she's trying to make her way to the Capitol a little more, and that's always good because this is the people's house, so we like to see as many people from our communities come in as possible. With that, Senator Kent, Senate File 332.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now we're going to, as was referenced earlier, talk about Senate File 332, which does go hand in hand with Senate File 1489. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present this bill to you, a bill that would restore funding after years of cuts to this vital public safety service. Senate File 332 would increase base level funding for crime victim service grantees. These grants are funded through the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs. As we all well understand, members, public safety is a critical core function of government. Minnesotans trust state government to provide this essential government function, and crime victim services are an essential part of public safety. As a bit of background, please know that crime victim services are provided to Minnesotans in need because they have been victims of a wide range of crimes, including sexual assault and exploitation, violent, financial, or elder abuse, or domestic violence. Examples of the kinds of services I'm describing include 24-hour crisis phone lines, transportation to a safe location, assistance in obtaining protective orders, support in court proceedings and criminal justice advocacy, child and youth services, access to critical hospital and medical care, to name just a few. Currently, after years of significant funding cuts to crime victim services, state dollars simply do not cover Minnesotans' needs. Funding has decreased 40% since 2001. And as you'll hear about in greater detail from our testifiers, crime victims are unable to access basic services due to strained agency capacity. Senate File 332 seeks to increase base-level funding for crime victim services by $10 million annually. I ask for your support in restoring funding to this critical public safety service and helping meet the need, the very real need, of many Minnesotans. I'm pleased to introduce our testifiers here in support of Senate File 332. Deborah Jessen is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime. Jean Renane, who you met earlier, is with MnCASA. And Liz Richards is the Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Thank you so much.
And would you like them, Senator Kent, in that order?
I believe so.
Okay, so we will have Ms. Jensen, if you'll say your name for the record and pull the mic closer to you so we can hear you and record this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chairman Champion and committee members. Good afternoon. Thank you for your time. My name is Deborah Jessen, Executive Director of Minnesota Alliance on Crime. And as you've been introduced to Ms. Ronayne and Ms. Richards, the three of us will be testifying on behalf of Senate File 332. You've all received and Senate File 332 will increase funding to crime victim services in Minnesota by $10 million a year. You've all received a packet of information that we'll be referencing as we go through the PowerPoint and testify. Most of us know someone who's a victim of a crime, and their stories are known to us. Their stories are also known to the crime victim service providers and victim advocates who work tirelessly to ensure that victims receive the help and resources they need. Here's a sampling of a few of the headline stories that show the wide diversity of crimes committed against Minnesotans, and it will be up on the screen. Sexual assault, abuse of pets to terrorize owners, elder abuse, strangulation victims, minors who are sex trafficked, domestic violence homicide.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Jean Ronayne, and I've recently assumed the position of Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. While this is a new position for me at MnCASA, I've been a long-term member of the coalition during my 17 years managing a crime victim program for Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted counties. So the people and the organizations that respond to crime victims are referred to as crime victim service providers. And in Minnesota, we classify these providers by the type of crime victim that they primarily serve. And if you look at your frequently asked questions document that's located in the left pocket of your handout, page one is going to list the different crime victim types, and that'll avoid me taking time to go into that. Each year, more than 113,000 Minnesotans receive assistance from these crime victim services programs, and this information comes directly from the Office of Justice Programs summary report. So the question might be, what do our crime victim services programs do for victims? They provide critical public safety services, such as those, again, that are detailed in your packet on page 2, and are also required standards by the Office for Justice Programs in distributing the grants. Now, each victim has a need for multiple services. So of those 113,000 individuals who received victim services, they received more than 1.8 million different services. We've already heard this afternoon of many different cases about the multiple needs for crime victim services. Most often, a single victim can present with multiple needs, like we see here on the slide. This graphic can show just a few of those needs, and it reminds us about how complex delivering crime victim services is. And again, yeah. This committee has heard this yet this afternoon. And new state and federal laws are adding to this complexity for crime victim services, and why these very new laws are intended to, and in many cases have helped identify previously unserved victims and improve a victim's access to justice. However, for the full impact of some of these new laws to be realized, we need these reliable crime victim services again. So there's just a couple of examples I wanted to share with the committee of these new laws, such as a new law that's pertaining to the surrender of firearms in domestic violence cases has impacted our service providers. The passage of the Campus Save Act means local campus officials are reaching out to some of our programs, and the increased focus on exploitation of elders. Crime victim services are indeed a core component of public safety. Not only do victims rely on these services for their safety and healing, but other criminal justice and health care providers are also relying on crime victim service providers and advocates to provide a safety net for the victim so that they can do their role on behalf of public safety. The work of Crime Victim Services programs is done in support of and in partnership with many of the other systems, such as law enforcement, the courts, prosecutors, schools, and medical centers. So the investment in Crime Victim Services programs is an investment in these systems as well.
And here's a brief history on Crime Victim Services funding. Minnesota's funded Crime Victim Services since 1978. Minnesota was one of the first states in the nation to recognize that these services are an essential government function. In 2011, during the state government partial shutdown, Minnesota District Court found that Crime Victim Services are a critical core function of the Minnesota state government. And the Crime Victim Service programs receive funding through the Department of Public Safety, the Office of Justice Programs. So they provide OJP, as we know it, provides base-level grants totaling approximately $32.5 million. This is a combination of state and federal dollars, approximately $9 million in federal dollars and $23 million in state dollars. And the Crime Victim Service dollars go to all 87 counties. You have a copy of this map in your packet that shows the geographical distribution of the funding. This reflects all of the Crime Victim Service dollars, both state and federal, but does not include the $17.8 million that are for domestic violence emergency shelter beds, because the funding increase we are seeking does not include those shelter beds.
So OJP is the largest funder for our crime victim services in the state. Our programs, depending on their local resources, do raise money through foundation grants, contracts with local government. They do fundraisers. They have business donations. But government, OJP funding, is the primary source of funding for these programs. And since 2001, state funding has significantly decreased. If you look on page 5 of the packet materials, you'll see a chart that lays out the actual dollar amounts of funding in 2001 and then again in 2015. In actual dollars granted, there's been an 18% overall decrease in funding. And we've adjusted these also for inflation, and we're using the Consumer Price Index, which does not include gasoline or food costs because those are considered too volatile. But if you look at the dollars adjusted for inflation, there's been a 40% decrease in state funds for this work since 2001. So the question is, what's been the impact of that decrease in lost dollars? We know that a few programs have actually closed. You heard about one, some of that earlier today. Many have scaled back. There's been a reduction in staff, closing of local satellite offices, and relying more heavily on volunteers. We did a sampling with victim service programs for 1 month last fall. We had 28 programs who recorded information on the services that they provided for each day of the month. Those programs were of differing sizes, located all around the state, and here's what we found. While the programs provided more than 84,000 services during that 1 month, at the same time, they were unable to respond to an additional 11,000 requests for services. They had to either delay or deny services.
And so, Ms. Richards, we're now over the 10 minutes, and so if I'll give you just, 30 seconds to sort of sum it up. I think we got it, though.
Okay, well, let me just give you a couple other things. We have the straining. One thing I want to let you know is that you've heard a number of requests today. A number of those would actually be benefited from this bill as well. Our money would go to all 131 grantees of Crime Victim Services dollars out of the Office of Justice Programming. So that does include a number of the people who testified earlier. So we wanted to make sure that you knew that. The other thing, we've also given you materials about how that money gets split out regionally around the state. And we gave you some specific information in your packet about how that might actually result in direct changes on the ground level. And we also, I know there's questions which are addressed in your packet about what's the oversight of these dollars that come through OJP. They have all kinds of oversight that they do, and that's delineated there as well. And finally, we have information about the sustainability beyond this ask, and that we would let you know that there are 150 agencies who are endorsing this ask and this bill, and those are also listed in your program.
Thank you so much. I know that you have so much great information, but I wanted to...
And Mr.
We waited so patiently.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Richards, this affects many other organizations, but you're not saying that those other organizations don't need the funding.
as much, correct?
Ms. Richards.
Because you're going to be working with them.
Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Senators. Where this money goes is it goes to those 131 programs. So that includes programs like Advocates for Family Pleas. It includes the currently funded Child Advocacy Center. It includes Voices of East African Women. It includes, right, so a number of the people that you heard testify absolutely say that they have that need. But we have 131 programs who could come here and give you just as compelling as information about their needs. And we're saying fund generally the crime victim services through the Office of Justice Programming and raise all of those programs up. This goes to their base level funding grants to all of those programs.
Thank you.
And a couple questions. So what was the funding level? I know currently you guys receive roughly $24 million annually, which is $48 million in the base, and you're asking now for another $20 million, which will get you to $68 million. Can you tell me what the base level funding was before you started seeing a decrease? Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Senator Champion. Let me just go back and correct a few things.
Okay.
Because part of what it's a difficult area to understand the funding. I know Executive Director of Office of Justice Programming, Raylan Magnuson, is here as well. But what the Office of Justice Programming does is it takes the $23 million in state dollars and they combine it with the $9 million of federal dollars and sort of mix it up to stretch the dollars and create the most stability they can for programs. Out of that $23 million, $17.8 million is for emergency shelter bed services. So it's a little bit complex in terms of what we're looking at. So if we go back to, and I believe the dollar amounts are in there as to what the funding levels were in 2001, in terms of what were, and that's just the state dollars that are in the frequently asked questions on page 5. Is that what I referenced correctly?
Yep.
For some reason, I can't pull it out. So in 2005, the base level grants, it gives you that figure right there, and that's the state dollars with no federal dollars combined, the $28,445,000. And so it's dropped down. The state dollars in 2015 were $23,328,000, and that's the 18% decrease in that time span. And then if you adjust it for the inflation,
it's adjusted.
Those are the numbers in the next columns.
All right. And so, hold on. Let's see what my other question is. And so what pretty much happened is that there was just a decrease, and then therefore you guys started receiving less.
Correct.
Is that right? Any other questions?
Mm-mm.
All right. Senator Kent, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I would just add, in the interest of time, to just say that, you know, one of the things that has impressed me the most about these types of programs and what they're able to do is not only what the staff is doing, but the way they leverage those with so many volunteer efforts. And when you have to make those cuts, you have an overall contraction of the ability to serve victims in so many different ways. So this has strong ripple effects, a multiplier effect, if you will, and, you know, this is money that goes far in many, many communities around our state.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the testifiers and for your patience. And Ms. Richards, thank you as well for all your great work. And with that, Senate File 332 will be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
All right. And so now Senator Hall is going to kind of have to take over because I'm going to come and do Senate File 1846, and I'm going to abide by my own time constraints.
We'll see about that.
All right. I think we're ready.
Senator Champion, you've got Senate File 1846.
All right. So
please
Senate
proceed.
File 1846 is a bill, as written, supports the work of our local prosecutors to receive important training to efficiently and effectively carry out their duties. As a lawyer myself, I'm 100% supportive of ensuring all lawyers who work on behalf of our justice system have the support they need to stay current in this field of ever-changing laws we pass here at the state capitol. And so the laws are important to understand, not only for those in the prosecutor's office, but also in our state public defender system, so that we are helping our entire justice system with the work we have asked them as taxpayers and policymakers to carry out. Because I do believe in equal educational opportunities for all in our justice system, I do have an amendment to bring forth a more balanced bill, if you will. So that would be the A1 amendment.
Okay. Senator Champion moves the A1 amendment. You want to speak to it first, or we just vote on it?
Just vote on because
okay.
It gets it.
All in favor say aye. Opposed, aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. And the ayes have it. The amendment is passed. Senator
and
Champion.
What, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what the amendment simply does is puts the bill in the order and shape that I would like for it to be, and it creates that balance that I talked about earlier. So not only are we looking at fiscally supporting the prosecutors, but we are also fiscally looking at supporting the public defender's office for public defender training. And so I have two testifiers to discuss the important work that can be done with these critically important training dollars. And I'm going to start with the judge. You know, I know him as Judge Smalls, but now he's the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. But he will always be known as Judge Smalls to me. So with that, Judge Smalls.
The Honorable Smalls, if you identify yourself and proceed.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Formerly a district court judge in Hennepin County, and that is what Senator Champion is referring to. Thank you for hearing Senate File 1846. This is a bill that is critically important to our association to bring about more training opportunities for our prosecutors and for those in law enforcement. Of course, a special thank you to Senator Champion for his leadership in bringing this bill forward. Since the 1980s, or the 80s, the early 80s, Minnesota County Attorneys Association has received some level of state funding designated for prosecutor training. Over the course of the last 20 years, that amount has ranged from $65,000 to $85,000. That has allowed us to train thousands of prosecutors, and we have provided an excess of 600 accredited classes as well as countless numbers of publications. Up until 2009, these funds were accounted for and transferred to our association from the Attorney General's office. Beginning in 2011, a legislative rider has provided a transfer of the $65,000 from the Attorney General's budget to the Department of Public Safety each year for prosecutor training. The Office of Justice Programs has then entered into a grant agreement with our association for that fund. Because the Office of Justice Programs is better suited to monitor and to distribute grant funds to our association, we are interested in a straight appropriation from the Office of Justice Programs in the future to provide these needed grant funds. The bill before you will provide $100,000 per year from the general fund to the Department of Public Safety for a grant to our association for prosecutor and law enforcement training. This is something that is done by the National Association of Prosecutor Coordinators told us that 25 of the 42 respondents indicated that their states provided such funding for prosecutor training, with most paying the costs to attend the training. To give you a sense of the scale and the scope of the training that we provide, we are able to provide all of our county attorneys, over 800 of their assistants, with the opportunity to earn sufficient continuing legal education hours each year to meet their mandatory reporting requirements. These opportunities also demonstrate the importance of our training courses, which are provided statewide. Our association is able to through programming, travel, and webinars, able to provide training throughout the state. Indeed, 67% of the attorneys attending our training are from greater Minnesota. So the $100,000 each year for training would provide for live courses on topics which are identified by our members, for technology through webinars, new trial school for which we hope to train 30 to 50 prosecutors annually, the course of updating various manuals and publications that we provide to our members, the post-approved training manual for law enforcement, And as Senator Champion noted, with the number of bills that are being passed, which include, for example, recommendations from the Child Protection Task Force to provide training by the county attorneys and for the county attorneys, a bill that you heard this afternoon on sex trafficking and juvenile sexual exploitation are just a few that we need to provide additional training on. So at the end of the day, folks, well-trained prosecutors result in more timely and fair resolution of cases, fewer appeals, and we continue to strive to provide that critically important training. So we thank you for the support of the bill.
And notice that I really do see him as a judge because I let him go over his time that was allotted. So now our representative from the Minnesota Public Defenders Association.
Mr. Chairman and members, Kevin Kyer, the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. And we are used to deferring to the bench as well, so we don't have a problem with it. Mr. Chairman and members, I would like to thank Senator Champion for bringing this bill forward and for recognizing the need for a balanced, not only a balanced approach, but having well-trained prosecutors and public defenders. Our goal with the money, if we can get it, is really threefold, is to start training our lawyers in forensics. We do a pretty good job. We have a trial school right now that we provide new lawyers their trial skills. We have a professional development weekend where we train folks in client communications, files, all of the things that you kind of think of in general terms of being a lawyer in the courtroom, setting up issues for appeal, those things. Where we haven't been able to provide that the training and where we're seeing more and more issues, and we talked about this during the budget hearing, is in the areas particularly of forensics, DNA evidence, electronic forensics or digital forensics and with computers, cell phones, you name the electronic device. And also in economic forensics, we're seeing more and more mortgage fraud cases, some of those issues where folks either don't have assets so they're a public defender client or their assets have been frozen and so they end up being public defender clients. And so those are our three main areas. We'd like to put together a training program where we train a group of our lawyers, hopefully in each of those areas or more, so that they can then provide training to the rest of the public defenders in the system. And that's really our goal.
Good. Thank you. Senator Champion.
So with that, again, it just creates an opportunity for these great servants who are public servants to get the training and the support that they need in order to make sure that they're carrying out the laws that we pass here at the Capitol. And I think it's important even for those who are indigent and don't have the resources to have attorneys who really have the intellectual capacity in order to go forward. And so that's why I think it's important, and I ask for support.
Good. Thank you, Senator Champion. I see no questions. you've done your closing.
That's it.
So we will take that under advice, and we will table this and for possible inclusion. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Champion?
Yes.
Since there's looks like no other business, do you want to adjourn? Do you want me to?
You know what? I just want to say thank you to staff and to you, Senator Hall. And I know that Senator Desick is sick, but we have taken great notes in order to make sure that she will be kept brought up to snuff on everything. And thank you so much to Chris and Ken and everyone. Thank you. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Next meeting? Do we have another meeting coming up?
I don't know yet.